Additional Parliament, Wednesday, 12th of June. We continue with the second reading of the Appropriation Act 2019. The Honourable Sir Michael Sacramento.
This is the last speech of this Parliament, and that it is the eighth time that I have been sworn to deliver a budget address. During our 2 terms in office, it has been my privilege to have held many portfolios. Of all those portfolios, there has been one that I have held from the very first day, and that is equality. I have devoted 13 years to for equality, a responsibility that I am very proud of. I think the foreign policy, or the Ministry of Foreign Policy, a department that we as a government created, and which for the first time is dedicated to upholding equality principles and eliminating all forms of discrimination. It has been immensely rewarding to have been at the helm of a responsibility that has been groundbreaking in philosophy, in ideas, in policy, and most importantly, in legislation. In December 2011, there was a fundamental change in that the electorate set a government that stands for fairness and equality for everyone in our community. Our progress has been such that many may well have forgotten that we took over from an administration that did not share these fundamental values. Equally, many will not have forgotten what it was like back then. As unimaginable as it may now seem, those were times when a foreign state struggle had to challenge the then establishment to be determined by the highest court in the land at great public expense in order to assert their rights to enjoy the tenancy of a government once or twice. Needless to say, that the Privy Council determined that the state had discriminated against this country. I have been facing with many such challenges this season. And none clearer and more obvious than inequality, and in particular, gay rights. Thankfully, those dark days are gone, and since the new dawn of December 2011, the imbalance on quality has been addressed, and such shortcomings addressed, because what for them was not even a dot on the radar of importance, in contrast, for us, has been a priority. Children considered to be a month to mark great gay pride. It is therefore fitting, I think, that I should commence my address, marking our progress in this important subject. It is incredible to now think that the first time that the word gay was mentioned in this Parliament was in my very first budget in 2012. And gay rights were first properly achieved in this House in 2014. Indeed, the first bill that I ever moved in this Parliament was the Civil Partnership Act. In March 2013, a landmark piece of legislation because for the first time in our history, it enabled the formal recognition of relationships between couples of the same sex. It was also progressive because it extended to opposite sex couples as well, something that we did ahead of the UK, where it was only just recently being changed as a result of a child. Up until that point, Mr. Speaker, gay men and women who lived in Gibraltar did not have their relationship, love, and commitment recognized in the eyes of the law. This act represented a historic step on what has been a long journey for respect, dignity, and above all, the recognition of gay couples. In our second term in office in October 2016, I brought the Civil Marriage Amendment Act to this House to allow for the civil marriage of gay couples. At the time, the response to the consultation paper was the most overwhelming that we had ever had, mostly in favour of the proposed bill. The passing of that act, again, demonstrated our commitment to reflect respect for all individuals regardless of their sexuality and also strengthening the institution of marriage, ensuring that it remains an essential building block of modern society. In addition, we have also legislated to outlaw homophobic hate crimes and hate speech in 2013, sex crimes and our unrelated offences. Mr. Speaker, equality is at the heart of this government and it's best for everyone. as a team, in recognition of our transgender community, we made the decision to extend protection from discrimination for individuals who have undergone gender reassignment. The Department of Equality is currently preparing an awareness and information program to raise awareness of the rights of individuals who have transitioned, and also works with partner departments to provide services to ensure that the members of the transgender community are supported. Mr. Speaker, our government's commitment to equality is embedded in everything that we do. Gender equality is another important strand of my policy portfolio. At the start of my tenure as Minister for Equality, I was keen to develop and introduce policies that would promote greater gender equality. Before that time, this was not something that was being discussed. I believe most resolutely that gender equality is a vital component of a mature and modern society, and it is an intrinsic factor in our quest for social justice. One of the strands of our gender equality strategy is the economic empowerment of women. The annual overall earnings gap, as disclosed from the employment survey, indicates that men earn significantly more than their female counterparts. We know that more gender diverse and inclusive teams, organizations, and businesses fare better than their diverse counterparts, than their less diverse counterparts. We know that having a gender balanced workforce and closing the gender pay gap can add millions to a country's economy. All this has been amply demonstrated and widely documented by global and international agencies, and these are indisputable and clear goals that the Ministry for Equality is working towards. In order to secure more precise data, this year I issued the Reuters first gender pay gap survey to accompany the employment survey. I'm very heartened by the positive response of the local business community. The survey, with this being the first year to voluntary, was given to employers who employed 20 or more employees, and we have had a response rate of 58%. In addition, a further 271 employers with less than 20 employees also returned a completed survey, so that is also very encouraging in the future. I look forward to the final analysis of the data, which will provide a clear picture of where horizontal and vertical segregation may exist in the workplace, and this will allow us to develop strategies to address these imbalances. My recent attendance at the Equal Pay International Coalition's technical conference announcement lately was a prime opportunity to keep abreast of how to promote better indicators, statistics, data, and policies to reduce the gender pay gap. Closing the gap is a moral and social issue with micro and macro economic benefits that we need to be clear of, and we will therefore continue to address. Gender representation of women in leadership and management is another issue of gender equality strategy is determined, and we have embarked on various initiatives to achieve it. The mentorship program for women is another important part of our strategy on the economic development and advancement of women. And I'm delighted to say that after the great success of the pilot cycle which we commenced last year, and saw the participation of 50 mentors and mentees, we have recently launched the second cycle. Interesting is an activity continuum, and what is a key indicator of its success is that over 50% of the mentors who participated in the pilot cycle have committed to participate in this cycle once again. Mr. Speaker, the program is going to extend to them. It has been very well received by the business community and enjoys the support of key stakeholder organizations, including the Chamber of Commerce, Federation of Small Businesses, Women in Business, Trade and Tech, and UI, all of whom are represented in the selection panel. I am most grateful, Mr. Speaker, to the Deputy Senior Governor, the Chief Minister, and all the other mentors who gave up of their valuable time to give back, and to everyone involved in making this important initiative a success. In some people's minds, this is important. Gender equality for the women's affairs, first by women and exclusively about women's business. This is an erroneous concern, and one that needs to change, and this is why we always involve men as well as women in our conversations. We are acutely aware that a contributor to the barriers that women face in their professional progression when it comes to and inclusion and specifically an unconscious goal for both the public and private sectors. I am delighted to say that the response to the training was extremely successful, with 100 attendees from the private sector. I believe that this engagement is telling of the business community's desire to ensure that women are more equitably represented in their workforce and to harness the potential of all their employees. The training was also delivered to over 140 public sector offices, including the uniform bodies. All who attended are eligible to put in employee boards and salaries. This represents approximately 2/3 of people involved in public sector recruitment. Challenging gender stereotypes is also an intrinsic part of our gender equality strategy. It is particularly crucial when advising on professions and career paths for all of us. Women are underrepresented in certain STEM fields, and we are working closely with the Department of Education, led by our good friend, the Minister for Education, the private sector entities, and NGOs for this. At the Ministry for Equality, we are used to dealing with matters that are innovative and groundbreaking. Another of our local centres in the quest for challenging gender stereotypes and advancing equality is the consideration of introducing practical paternity and or parental leave. Traditionally, women disproportionately take the majority of the responsibility of childcare. This is one of the contributors of the gender pay gap, where the gap widens around the age that most women have children. Furthermore, it is important to make the rest that are available to mothers equitable with fathers, so that fathers can play a more active role in childcare from an early age, and effectively give couples more flexibility at an important time in the family's life to choose who looks after the children. Introducing parental leave would also benefit those in same-sex relationships. After extensive research on the matter, having been undertaken by the Ministry for Equality, we are now ready to commence a consultation to introduce proposed changes to maternity leave to explore the options of paternity or parental leave, which will be undertaken as soon as the consultation paper is finalized. We will be consulting with stakeholders, including the private sector, the Chamber of Commerce and the Federation of Small Businesses, as well as consulting with trade unions. The government is clear, Mr. Speaker. We must move away from maternity leave to parental leave. Our consultation will be online. Mr. Speaker, the local political arena, as you know, is another area where women are underrepresented and warrants attention if women are to consider leadership positions and participate more actively in the democratic process, and this helps is to be more representative of our community. As I always say, there is nothing that I would like more than to see a more gender balanced parliament. I am hoping that the proposal to extend parliament to include that country will also assist in this. And that is not to say, Mr. Speaker, that I believe that women should not be under sanction along their main candidates. As Mr. Foreign Policy and also as Ambassador for the Girl Guide Movement, it was lovely to invite guys from colleagues at my offices ahead of International Women's Day this year. The aim of the event was to promote discussion of gender equality, as well as to provide insight into the workings of Parliament and of women's sectors in Gibraltar and in the UK. Another aspirational moment, as I hope that I may have planted a few seeds in the minds of these young ladies, and I will continue my work with them on this front. Challenging gender stereotypes through raising awareness and information events is also central to the work undertaken by the Ministry of Equality. Marking International Women's Day by all of the students is now firmly established in the school calendar. It is a combination of an expression of the issue through speech as well as through art. And it is very important that the younger members of our community are given an opportunity to reflect upon and articulate their views on gender equality. This year, we extended our traditional gender equality art competition and use the winning images to create a gorgeous national stamp for international audiences. It gives me great satisfaction that their message and the banner stamp is literally traveling the world. I also promote the concept of every opportunity that I have when I travel, particularly since the majority of my travels in particular time has been on the top of the gender equality. I'm also particularly proud to say that they are also in royal hands, as I was able to present a first-day cover of the stamp to Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Norfolk when we met at a reception in New York City. We know that a world free from gender stereotypes would allow each individual to develop their full potential, free from limiting roles and expectations. The work we can do is to narrowly demarcate and rigorously police what women and men can do, say, or aspire to become. Some may say that a lot of gender stereotypes are imposed on us from a young age, even in the way that gender is human fairy tales, where the girl is either a helpless victim or a beautiful princess, waiting to be rescued by some charm. On that basis, and for these concepts to be given some thought, and indeed balance, I am arranging a short story competition where I will encourage that such stereotypes be challenged by our community. We should never be complicit in making the full range of human emotions for men and women. The work that we can do to create, believe in, and perpetuate hyper-feminine and hyper-masculine stereotypes that do not reflect the full range of human experience. That is a type of control that can prove to be very damaging and even simple. Consequently, changing gender stereotypes is extremely important, as we know that these can have an impact on the specific physical and mental health challenges for men in our community. That is why the Ministry for Equality also marked International Women's Day at the Continental Scene in the last few years. Additionally, last year we also celebrated International Women's Day by organizing an information awareness raising event, together with the Creator of Mental Health and Public Health Services, and local charities, Foster Council, Support Group, and Youth Farms in the mountains of November for the first time. We look forward to building upon this initiative in the coming year, and would like to galvanize the entire community to support our endeavors. I am also the guide of the Gender Equality Institute, and last year I also amended the legislation to provide for breastfeeding in public places, so to support and protect mothers who choose to do so without discrimination. Returning to domestic abuse, this is something that has been at the forefront of my policy agenda. Early on in my tenure, I set up a working group with a view to producing a national strategy on domestic abuse that is dealing with issues in a consistent and consolidated manner. The working group is made up of the head of key stakeholder government departments. The role of this group is twofold: first, to inform that a government department will have robust internal policies to deal with instances of domestic abuse, and additionally, that their policies are aligned in a way that they work together in implementing it closely. As it is likely that those who encounter abuse will require the support of more than one service, and ensure that there are proper referral pathways so that they are afforded with the best protection available. Those who suffer domestic abuse are entitled to feel safe. Mr. Speaker, I am acutely aware of the issue as well, because I am constantly approached by individuals who have suffered domestic abuse and they tell me their stories firsthand. Only in this past week I have seen two such individuals. This strategy is working well, but of course is under constant review because there is always room for improvement. Over the past few months, I have personally met with the heads of each of the relevant departments who have been productive on the progress being made. One of the focuses at the moment is to gather statistical data in a better way, in a way that is holistic between the departments. Of course, continuous training is fundamental to strengthen the understanding of the subject matter. Indeed, some of the representatives from the working group will be attending a domestic abuse conference in London next week. Awareness, Mr. Speaker, is also key, and we have run a very successful awareness campaign by way of an information system, postal and public sector offices are now even on the back of buses to make them more visible. Additionally, the Department of Equality works very closely with the Department of Education and deliver the respect program in schools in an age-appropriate way. Another successful multi-agency initiative that is also going from strength to strength. Support is also far more, Mr. Speaker. And Minister Gosling announced that yesterday two additional councillors in the care agency will also go a long way to help tackle this matter. Mr. Speaker, I was formerly working with and the strategy is coordinated from my office. In addition to thanking those involved in leading on this in their respective departments, I would like to single out the staff in my office as well. Town Council Karina Kitchen and the personal assistant John McLeod. Coincidentally, Mr. Speaker, is also in addition responsible for our very effective awareness campaign. The throwaway comments made by the leader of the opposition on Monday demonstrate not only how little he knows about the project, but also how little he has thought he knows. Because despite the announcement that I have made in progress, he seems to just refuse to even acknowledge it. If anyone is out of touch with the people, Mr. Speaker, making our community safe through effective public protection has been one of the highest priorities throughout my time in office. I chair the Strategic Management Board of a multi-agency public protection partnership that is responsible for the assessment and management of the list for pay registered sex offenders and persons of interest in our community. Designated training professionals from each of the partnership agencies have undertaken specialist training, which is commissioned annually and takes place over the course of a couple of weeks and broader. As chair of that Strategic Management Board, I have made the point to ensure that no stone is left unturned when it comes to the public protection of this nature. It has been a priority that all other partner agencies understand the work of MAPA is crucially important. Prevention and reduction of risk is paramount, and this rehabilitation is a crucial intervention work. The risk managers are all highly trained in intervention work, and this allows them to provide specific behavioral therapy and sex offender specific rehabilitation programs. This is because I would like to thank everybody involved in MAPA at every level, because it's something that is very difficult to do, and I would also particularly like to thank the Deputy Chair, the Commissioner of Police. Speaker, turning now to disability, there can be no doubt that this government has done more to promote inclusion of people with disabilities than any other before. The Ministry for Equality has been extremely busy since its inception, and the most landmark progress being the introduction of the Disability Act last June. The Act changes the dynamic, and disability and inclusion really have a priority focus throughout the public sector in a way that is unprecedented. Naturally, legislation and human rights, but that is only part of our approach. We have always taken it further by developing policies, promoting the practice and training and awareness. The introduction of the Disability Act was quickly followed by the passing of the Building Rules approved document by our regulations, which is similar to the Part M in the UK and gives the Department of Town Planning and Building Control the tools it needs to ensure that all new building projects are as accessible as they can be. We have drawn a line, Mr. Speaker, and we have set the standards now needed to ensure Gibraltar is more inclusive and future. As for existing buildings, Mr. Speaker, we heard the Chief Minister announce relief to incentivize businesses and encourage more inclusive spaces within the next 6 months. Even before the planning asked for the legislation, Mr. Speaker, we were preparing the terrain by ensuring that enough training opportunities were given to the relevant authorities and health departments within the public service. Indeed, much of this training was also offered to the private sector. Since we took office, it was already the policy of the government, part of the legislative changes, that all our projects were accessible, our new projects followed, and then many existing services were also recovered to make them accessible. It is therefore safe to say that we have changed the landscape on equality. And I mean this literally as well as in the philosophy. Let's remember that we announced our intention to pass the Disability Act, Mr. Speaker, that the Ministry of Equality was already making the necessary arrangements to provide familiarization training for the new Act to all parts of the public service. Indeed, the private sector has also had a chance to learn more about the new Act at our recent Disability Symposium. A symposium aimed at local businesses and also portrayed the benefits to a business that is inclusive. This symposium on disability is a first for the program and included professionals who spoke about the law on disability, on making services accessible, interacting with people who have learning or communication difficulties, and it was also a part of an appropriate language of advocate. All in all, a very varied program which was very well received. Mr. Speaker, the Ministry of Equality has of course continued to provide training during the last financial year. Last summer, the Disability and Language Etiquette Training, which forms part of the Government Human Resources Training Program now, was delivered to all lifeguards and beach attendants employed that year as part of their training program. This training was also extended to toilet attendants serving public beaches in the bathing pavilion. The same training had already been delivered the previous year to parts of the civil service, employees of both bus companies that provide our public bus service and private event organizers. We have already seen the benefits this training provides. As you may remember, the initiative introduced a couple of years ago that we brought in front, where sensory adaptations were made for the first couple of hours to allow access to people with autism, photosensitive epilepsy, and visual or hearing impairment. Also, the sensory performances made available by Lower Cinemas and by the Gibraltar International Music Festival. These initiatives came about because of the training and learning opportunities the Ministry of Equality had organized, and Gibraltar did all the better for it. During the last financial year, Mr. Speaker, the Ministry of Equality has also continued to provide training on awareness. The latest seminar of our Oxford series, Working with Families for 6 years, was once again very well attended by the public and workers from the Department of Education and the Care Agency. Further training and awareness in learning disabilities and autism was also given to NGOs that already attended the Tier 1 training the previous year. We are planning a further seminar on autism in the autumn. The result, Mr. Speaker, is that since the inception of the Ministry for Equality, there are now more professionals, NGOs, and family members aware of autism and learning disabilities in general. This awareness leads to a better understanding of your role as a parent, professional, or leader, and this in turn leads to a more inclusive society. This has always been my aim, Mr. Speaker, to open up the water for the benefit of all who live in or visit it. That is why under this government, this staff are being seen as some of the most accessible in the world. This is why we have provided platforms and signs for our major events so that people can join their family and friends and not have to stay at home. This is why this government continues to invest in training and continues to try and make Gibraltar more inclusive. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, it was our government who introduced the change in places toilets. And for those who may not be aware, this is a larger than an accessible toilet, and it means room to cater for people who have severe mobility impairments and may need the use of a post and an average changing room. Gibraltar already has a number of changing post toilets. In fact, more than what is usually found in cities much larger than this. I still wish to improve further, and my ministry is liaising with the Department of the Environment to get this off the ground as soon as possible. The Ministry of Equality is also in consultation with their colleagues at the Department of Education in order to improve disability awareness in the classroom. This is an important step in ensuring that inclusion becomes second nature for future generations. I would like to add, Mr. Speaker, at this point, my thanks to my good friend, the Minister for Education, teachers and staff at the Department of Education, who from the very beginning have shown to be eager to attend all the training and informative seminars we have provided and have supported us in our message all the way. It is thanks to to the feedback that we receive from them, that we are now working together to identify relevant training that will enable them to further foster and improve in the classroom. As part of our objective to promote inclusion and independence with the people, our latest progress is that of the Ministry of the Ministry for Equality has launched the Disability Information Card. This initiative is purely voluntary, but it will allow the user to carry a card that can be used as a discrete communication tool. In order to ensure that this project is as successful as possible, the Ministry for Equality consulted key stakeholders, disability groups, and charities at the beginning of the planning procedure. This card, Mr. Speaker, will be especially useful to people with invisible disabilities, but may need to communicate their needs in a discreet way, and could be particularly useful to users that may find themselves alone or in a situation where they would otherwise find it difficult to communicate to others. The information contained in this card will also be beneficial in an emergency situation, as all emergency services were consulted at the qualification stage and are aware of its use. All in all, Mr. Speaker, it is abundantly clear that our government's commitment to equality has not only resulted in remarkable progress in achieving an inclusive society and in the recognition of modern Gibraltar. I am extremely proud of the work undertaken by the Ministry of Equality, a department that I've seen grow and are in no small measure responsible for such progress. It is of the true dedication of a small and hard-working team headed by Sabina Duran. I will now turn to my housing responsibilities. Housing is a fundamental cornerstone of our community. It is without a shadow of a doubt, Mr. Speaker, that our government has a track record in the provision of the housing needs for Gibraltar at every level. Providing affordable housing to a high standard is a top priority for us, Mr. Speaker, not least because of its natural consequences on the demand on the overall housing waiting list. In our first term in office, Mr. Speaker, we provided almost 1,000 new homes by building 2 new estates of each two terraces and 1 open room. After that, we sold our 161 homes that were formerly energy policy. In this term, Mr. Speaker, we have announced 3 new housing estates. We have already launched a thousand new territories and brought them to me. At the end of this month, we will be launching the 3rd estate on the site of the 1st home. In all, Mr. Speaker, these estates will provide a total of a further 1,365 homes. I know that there are many families who are very excited at these new opportunities. In relation to the thousands of new territories alone, we have received 2,351 applications. That is almost 4 times the number of flats available, and therefore cost as to the interest in acquiring these properties. Importantly as well, we have introduced stringent measures to do away with the speculation on abuse and accept profit on resales in future to ensure that affordable housing continues to be available and affordable. The Leader of the Opposition, Mr. Speaker, acknowledges that this is a process. They do, however, describe it as a minor adjustment. This, Mr. Speaker, is anything but minor. It is a fundamental shift that I propose that offering a double congratulations is too much, even for me. This review is a real game changer, Mr. Speaker, and on the whole, the response to it has been overwhelmingly positive. There may be some who don't like it, but all that we have with them is that they did not purchase for the right conditions. I have one further new announcement to make, Mr. Speaker, in relation to changes made to the resale of affordable housing, and that is in relation to those who own property on pro-rata terms, yet up until now, the practice has been to sell them on terms as if they were owned on a 100% basis. Having acquired the remaining share from the person that sales, but it's a completion. This is not what was intended in practice, and we would be writing to all practitioners setting up a new mechanism whereby homeowners must purchase any remaining share of their property with their own funds before being able to sell on a 100% basis. So, Mr. Speaker, to follow, in our two terms in office, we have offered a total of 2,181 affordable rooms for sale, compared with a total of 807 flats offered by the PSB in their fourth term in office. Essentially, we have provided over 2.5 times of what the PSB did in last settlement. I make this point, Mr. Speaker, because yesterday, the leader of the opposition said that housing in Gibraltar was broken. Nothing could be further from the truth. What was broken, Mr. Speaker, was their system, and not providing the constant flow of loans. And what was literally broken, Mr. Speaker, was a block of Nelson's New, Daisy and Cumberland, that they built, but where this administration has, as we heard the Chief Minister say on Monday, had to invest hugely in remedying the defects. Mr. Speaker, they make a lot about the fact that they built an estate for rental at Mid-Harbour Estate. It's not, Mr. Speaker, that one estate that they built, that is broken, literally, as well, due to voters and fortune too. And the taxpayer will have to remedy that too. I await to hear the full extent of the report and what is required in that respect. Mr. Speaker, in addition to the construction of affordable homes for fortune, we have also built purpose-built flats for the elderly. In our first term, we built Childhood House and St. Martha Lodge. I have already announced that we will be constructing further purpose-built homes for the elderly in the new affordable housing estate, replicating the successful model of St. Martha Lodge. Both new estates will therefore provide additional rental flats, which will have a knock-on effect on the rental stock available by the release of this rental accommodation. It is clear, Mr. Speaker, or rather, going to be clear to everyone, except some, that there will be a direct knock-on effect on the demand of the housing waiting list for rental. Regrettably, Mr. Speaker, the GSD have a one-track mind in this regard. They continuously repeat their mantra of demanding mean testing for housing, which shows just how out of touch with reality they are, because this just does not work. Another baffling argument that they propose is that young adults should be precluded from joining the housing waiting list, essentially preventing them from the chance of getting into the system, again demonstrating the GSD's little understanding of how the system works. By providing a continuous stream of affordable housing, people aspire to purchase in such schemes, and this has a much better net effect on the waiting list for rentals than those who cannot afford to do so. It is that simple. A broken housing system is one where you don't provide sufficiency, and that, Mr. Speaker, is what they did. And that's a real legacy problem that we have to inherit if we have turned it around. That is why we gave careful thought to our category when in allocation to achieve the fairest all-round allocation priority in the new affordable housing. In the first round of applications for our 7 continuing territories, we have at present received applications from 130 people who would release taking possession of government flats on completion. In addition to this, Mr. Speaker, I am also happy to announce a new initiative in relation to elderly people who own their own homes. We have had many approaches from people, most of whom live in the first wave of affordable housing schemes and therefore now at an age where they would much prefer to live in the purpose-built flats for the elderly, and they have expressed to us their wish to surrender their own homes in order to take up the opportunity to live in rented purpose-built accommodation. Mr. Speaker, maybe some people in water centres may be interested in what I'm about to announce, because on this basis, Mr. Speaker, given the interest that has been expressed to us, I can announce that those who wish avail themselves of rental flat surrendering on the basis that the property being surrendered is worth at least the development value of the rental contract. In addition to this notification, let's also recall the number of post-war rental accommodations that were sold off under the GST policy. We stopped this practice, but in the end, there were flats. There were 183 flats sold in total. This was a bad deal for everyone involved, and I am often contacted by those who regret having purchased, particularly more elderly people, because they would much rather avail themselves from moving into a purpose-built flat for the elderly instead. Mr. Speaker, we heard the Chief Minister announce on Monday the rate at which the government will reimburse everyone who has changed their minds for having purchased these personal flats. If everyone were to return their flats, Mr. Speaker, we would have a further 183 flats returned to the rental stock that has been denied to us. Essentially, Mr. Speaker, it is the equivalent of building a small estate of rental flats, which has been denied to us. It is painful to hear the GST say that housing is broken. If anyone broke it, Mr. Speaker, it was them. And they did service for us, and they cannot hide from that fact. They just don't seem to understand the consequences of the neglect of our community's housing needs, and still don't understand how this would be not, because they continue to insist that it could be constructed on homes for rental to top of the waiting list. So, with the point, Mr. Speaker, back to the numbers. And demonstrate how by constructing affordable housing and rental homes for the elderly, as well as the return of possible flats sold, that increased the rental stock, with its obvious natural consequential effect on the housing waiting list, without having to construct additional flats for rental. The figure as follows, Mr. Speaker. 130 flats returned by those who have applied for a fund from too many charities and were given taking possession of some confusion. No doubt there would be more in the auditing of common development, but let's stick to the figure of 130 for now. 119 new homes for elderly rental accommodation in the forthcoming estate that we are building. After that, Mr. Speaker, 142 left for elderly rental already built at Salisbury Town Hall and Sea Master Road. And further, 183 post-war sales flats which have been taken from the rental stock. They should never have been left from our rental stock, Mr. Speaker. And if all were to be returned, we would have an additional 183, and I sincerely hope that they are. So that, in total, Mr. Speaker, is effective. An additional 574 homes for rental returned to stock so far in our two terms. That provides, Mr. Speaker, just slightly less than all of the rental stock in our two terms in office and they built in their full terms in office with little more space than they need a house and all the systems. Needless to say, Mr. Speaker, the additional construction of affordable housing, which I have not factored into this figure, will naturally alleviate the remainder of the waiting list. The mathematics just must be clear, Mr. Speaker, and I can't understand how they can be so blinded as to next year. And that is, Mr. Speaker, allocation as a direct result of our construction alone. We must add to that allocations of rental stock by way of the normal turnover of the housing department rental flats. And when I say normal turnover, Mr. Speaker, I must congratulate my department because the turnover this year is anything but normal because we've had a record number of allocations. Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, insofar as providing rental accommodation for those on the waiting list who are unable to afford to purchase, I am extremely proud to say that the housing department is providing a turnover of refurbished flats for allocation at the record fastest rate ever. This is one of the real successes of the housing department. And the figures prove the unprecedented performance of this department, which has serviced a truly dedicated, professional, and hard-working team. To put that into context, Mr. Speaker, a total of 265 allocations have been granted since the 1st of April last year. To date, and of these, 37 have been to senior citizens by way of participants not for the elderly. This, Mr. Speaker, is an incredible achievement and a record high, considering that there is no longer the direct knock-on effect of the beaten territories and months of new charges and housing team afterward allocations, the benefit of which we mostly took last year when we had a high number of 312 allocations. But the year before that, Mr. Speaker, in 2016, the number of allocations was 109. The year before that, in 2015, the figure was 124. So, Mr. Speaker, the evidence is that this year's figures are a true testament to the improved working of the housing department, and we are seeing the results of the focused changes that we have made. Mr. Speaker, since the 1st of April 2019, the housing department has received a total number of 662 applications for bond housing. The reporting office of the housing department continues to process reports and forward these to the relevant departments and authorities. We continue to obtain feedback for clients on the project and the progress of work by way of counter-taking calls and emails. We have established a good proactive working environment with a large number of entities, such as the housing agency, the environmental agency, the development office, technical services, the town of the world, the water police, the water car park, the voting rights authority and the care agency. Mr. Speaker, in 2018, the Housing Department Reporting Office received a staggering total of 15,287 reports for repairs and refurbishment of flats. The Reporting Office now has a more leading role in the management of the workloads and flat refurbishment. And in order to accelerate the allocation of flats, a very tight deadline is set for their refurbishment. Mr. Speaker, I have set key performance indicators in the housing department as if it were a private company that needs to report its shareholders. And we take into account the work for their funds, and the reporting office is in key care in ensuring that the departmental KPIs are met. They trust that Mr. Speaker, and they liaise on a daily basis with the housing works agencies and the subcontractors in order to achieve that the targets and the deadlines are met. And our traffic light system that we have recently implemented allocates different targets depending on the complexity of the work. But on average, Mr. Speaker, the turnaround and the refurbishment of the flat is no longer than 3 months, whereas in previous administrations, the more likely average is closer to 2 years. All information on the refurbishment is updated daily in order to achieve this. Mr. Speaker, the housing department continues its hard work in the recovery of rental yields as well. Since the department commenced its concerted efforts of recovery in 2016, it has to date reduced the outstanding amount by £1.3 million. But more importantly, it's going to put the brakes on the pace of which arrears have been accumulated. This has been achieved by using a multifaceted approach, by expanding the options available to teams in which to make payments of rent. It allows the tenant the flexibility to be able to pay by their preferred option, whether this is online by way of standing order or by a deduction from their salary of pensions. Payments, therefore, Mr. Speaker, are being given over the course. I'm happy to say that 65% of rent is now collected by the 6-year method. We therefore ensure that rent is paid. We are now also engaging with the private sector for employees who offer this facility to their employees who wish to make for their employees who are government terms and they wish to take the tax. The department has also ensured that the correct systems are in place and notifications are received and alert the department if any tenant commences to default on their rent immediately. This process enables them to contact the tenant far sooner than ever before and engage with them before any debt begins to build up and becomes a further burden on the tenant. The department continues to meet with tenants and daily very useful as they allow the department to identify those trends that have genuine hardship and are unable to pay their rent. All cases are considered on a case-by-case basis. Careful consideration is given to those who may have a social or medical aspect. This helps the department determine those who generally can't pay and those who do not want to. In 2018, a total of 283 interviews have been held with tenants in arrears. They have made agreements with the housing department in order to repay the outstanding debt. The amount secured via agreement, Mr. Speaker, and this is very significant because it may not necessarily reflect when we talk about the balance that's recovered, but this is the balance that's been secured by way of agreement, is £606,362. No, sorry, Mr. Speaker, that's the one thing. The housing department, by way of agreement, has secured £2,034,655. So that is the significance of that process, Mr. Speaker. Again, something else that didn't really exist before. However, Mr. Speaker, despite all of these initiatives, and as the department continues to strive to engage with all those in arrears, there is regrettably a minority of tenants who can pay and cannot pay. These tenants have no social or economic hardship, which would qualify them for rent relief, and yet they continue to default. For these people, the department has therefore been left with no option but to commence legal action to recover the unpaid debt. And to this end, the cases have already been sent to the Office of the Director of Public Prosecution to pursue recovery of arrears in court. As you can see, Mr. Speaker, the housing department as a whole has taken a very proactive approach in ensuring that none of the tenants either fall behind in payments, causing an increase of arrears, and certainly not at the unprecedented rate of 2011. The reality, Mr. Speaker, is that it is very difficult to recover arrears of rent after 20 years of no action whatsoever. As an example, Mr. Speaker, there are, and the legal regulation may wish to know this figure, there are 231 tenancies which owe rent, but whose tenants passed away before December 2011, and that's a point to put here how difficult recovery is. But one example, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, we have a very close relationship with the various tenants associations and the help and guidance that they offer in relation to issues in their particular estate is always incredibly helpful. Mr. Speaker, turning to the establishment of housing estates, last year I was honoured in declaring that both Glasgow estate and North Castle estate were both virtually complete. The most changes to these estates have most certainly exhausted the living standards of tenants and visitors alike. This is more noticeable in Glasgow estate and the Gunner estate, estates that have made a big positive impact to the skyline and the area, being one of the main asset factors into the water. First impressions are of paramount importance, and when you provide a much-needed mega-uplift to existing buildings in states, once considered the forgotten state, you end up with two brand-new estates. These estates, Mr. Speaker, will not be maintained by themselves, and that is why the government will be further exploring the implementation of maintenance and repair programs so that these estates do not fall into disrepair again. It must be further expressed that the magnitude and success of this government's enterprise is down to the sheer determination of all those involved in the project, from the Ministry for Housing by way of the Housing Department and the Housing Agency to the contractors, to JBS, and all the service providers and subcontractors. The three projects have gone beyond their original and predetermined scope, but this has also been due to additional work and our significant variation that will complement the overall appearance of the estate. Mr. Speaker, the government will also commit to carry out external refurbishment of other housing rental buildings that form part of the government's remit. And there are many, Mr. Speaker, that we have already commenced and are very close to completion, such as our amazing estate, Mr. Speaker, which is going to house, Mr. Speaker. That one day, Mr. Speaker, which will look glorious once we finish it very, very shortly. and to name only two of those. But, Mr. Speaker, the important thing is that we ensure that we have robust maintenance programs for all our estates going forward, so that we do not fall into disrepair again. Telehousing, Mr. Speaker, and in addition to all this, we also have an ambitious project of urban renewal, of government free with properties in the town. We have been very proactive in identifying many properties that were empty during the 50 years, and many have been sold to provide further housing. Already, Mr. Speaker, 20 tenders have resulted in over 120 dwellings. We continue to develop urban renewal, and there is a specific project where the remaining freehold dwellings continue to be strategically decanted so that tenders can be undertaken in practice. And Mr. Speaker, when the Leader of the Opposition referred to the auditor's report on Monday in relation to void properties, the majority of the void properties relate to these properties which have been decanted for the benefit of the urban renewal project. As a result of this project, Mr. Speaker, we are about to issue a tender for the next one. The renewal of the old marriage quarters next to Marsh Park of the State. This building consists of 10 apartments of varying sizes and a tender notice to the different sources. Mr. Speaker, turning to controlled rent, I have already announced that I have set up a working group to undertake a thorough review of the housing act. This commitment arises out of the need to make necessary changes so that the legal framework works more efficiently and for the government as well as for those who serve. This review also includes the provisions that relate to private residential landlords and tenants, and particularly the concerns on sold rent. The review has already highlighted a number of amendments which would be required. These have been drawn up as a result of a consultation process which of course is ongoing. The latter is something that has been ongoing with the process of government, but I believe, Mr. Speaker, that this is the first time that a review including professional advisors and stakeholders has occurred. I have personally met with the representatives of the newly established Landlord Association on a couple of occasions, and we have agreed on a couple of principles going forward. I have also received representations from Action for Housing, which are most helpful. The key, Mr. Speaker, is to find a balance that is realistic in this day and age, while maintaining to protect tenants with particular rights. We need a fair resolution to the problems and issues that are currently faced. It goes without saying that decontrolling rent is not an immediate short-term solution, and there is no need for concern by those who are afforded government protection. The government approach is a long-term, holistic, and integrative one to deal with the problems that arise from the housing act, and balance this with the government's drive for urban renewal, particularly for the regeneration of the upper tenants. Government has a duty to ensure that tenants who have the benefit of controlled rent are not rendered homeless. However, it is equally acknowledged that extremely low rents are no longer sustainable in the long term, as this makes it almost impossible to maintain. At the same time, it is that tenants cannot continue to live in such standard conditions. I am committed, Mr. Speaker, to changing the law to achieve a fair outcome. On the basis of representation from stakeholders that I have received, I have already commissioned a thorough study of rent control properties in Gibraltar, and will issue a consultation paper as soon as this is concluded. An immediate change that I have already commissioned is the creation of a register specifically for controlled tenancies, so that there is a clearer picture of the situation, and will also protect everyone from the abuse by fictitious tenants. Finally, in some housing, Mr. Speaker, during this year, Mrs. Josephine Redding has been appointed the Principal Housing Officer. My congratulations to the leading lady of the Ministry for Housing on her promotion. As well, of course, Mr. Speaker, to her truly dedicated team at the Housing Department. My thanks also, of course, to my team at the Housing Works Agency led by Ruben Rodriguez. Let me for the continued changes in working practices which we have implemented and given effect to the changes we have seen. Mr. Speaker, I would like to thank all the groups and voluntary organizations that we work with and provide us with the invaluable advice as we strive to reach our common objectives. Last but by no means least, office led by my private secretary, Audrey Weller, called an indefatigable dedication to the work that we do on a daily basis and to the commitment, Mr. Speaker. On some days, it feels as if the whole of Gibraltar calls our office to help, but they will always endeavor to help everyone with dedication and the passion that they always do. Mr. Speaker, finally, I wish to extend the thanks to the press, to the clerk, and to the team here in Parliament, particularly to the clerk who looked after me so well in all our CPAs and travels, and given me particularly my heavy involvement with the CWC, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, it has been a year where the Chief Minister and the Deputy Chief Minister have once again pulled their unflinching dedication to our community, navigating the treacherous waters presented by the But Mr. Speaker, with your leadership and my government colleagues working together as a team, we have provided our best for our development. Thank you.
The Honourable Robin Thomas. Mr. Speaker, it is with great honour that I rise to deliver my fourth budget address. In all likelihood, the final one I shall deliver to this Parliament in the near future. It has been a tremendous privilege to serve this community over the past few years. In order to serve our people, in one of the most critical junctures, has not just been a major learning curve, but more importantly, a duty I have executed with pride. I hope people whom I have met through the joint selection of my time in public life have felt that I have represented them well. I certainly have given them my best shot. Before addressing the areas of my responsibility, I shall touch upon some of the initiatives I have met for the past year since my last budget address. To this day, the issues which I have raised are still affecting our community. In the speech I would like to start my address with what I feel is the most important area within my federal responsibility, that is mental health. An area which could continue to remain at the top of the political agenda. The appropriation of almost £130 million towards the health budget, only a very small percentage for the national factory for mental health services. 6% in 2017 by the Ministry of Education. Mr. Speaker, I say so once more, according to the Honourable Minister for Health, just 6% of the budget reaches mental health services. As a result, there is still a long way to go before mental health is treated equally to that of physical health. I welcome the recent announcement from the Minister for Health regarding the new liaison nurse consultation use as an improvement to the existing service. However, I strongly believe that this is simply not enough and more radical policies have to be implemented. I have publicly stated what the GOP position is regarding mental health. Firstly, the need to care for persons within the community as much as possible by expanding the domiciliary care and mental health services and starting a household care services space. Secondly, we believe there is a need to create supportive internships for persons living with mental health problems. I would like to take this opportunity to recognize the good work done by the charity Positive Partners in this area, but far more needs to be done, and I shall talk about the positive employment later in my address. Thirdly, the GSP's public policy is that there is a need for a crisis and management team to deal with instances of crisis, but also follow-up care and management services. Not just over, I also took the mental and the healthy mind matter serving. The point of this was to try and understand what the drivers affecting mental and well-being are, together with what the issues that affect service users living with mental health illnesses are too. I was pleased it did in fact serve its purpose. One of the main points revealed in the survey was how easily people who are living with mental health issues can give up on seeking appropriate care if the appropriate care service is not there to embrace them. Mr. Speaker, accessibility is key. Additionally, for those persons already in the system, there are instances in breakthrough continuity of care, and an apparent lack of aftercare which dramatically undermines the chances of long-lasting recovery. during the summer of last year, there was a major crisis in the mental health service, with a rapid turnover of psychiatrists, or rather, the lack of active psychiatrists in that community. The crisis was eventually overcome, psychiatrists were brought in. However, I am still to this very day receiving concerns from service users as to turnover of psychiatrists, and how the care and relationship with the professional is effectively reset to zero every time a contract is not renewed or a psychiatrist resigns simply because of the instability of the case. Therefore, the government's recent announcement for an AHS stress has been assigned the responsibility of assessing the function of the service is not enough. We must do more to ensure that there is not only that we retain the best professionals in the service, but that we increase the investment in resources and not just in the building. We must do more to ensure that there is a liaison team who can properly manage and care in and outside of the community. Service units build a relationship over time with consultants and professionals, and it is safe to say that it is simply not right to have this claim of the health system every time there is a need for something. In the speeches of the last year, I have tried to understand the low morale and absenteeism in the GHA. Last year, I carried out a survey on low morale, and the results coincide with everything that is being said by our union as workers, not just in our health sector, but in law enforcement agencies and civil service departments too. Workers feel neglected and often not consulted. Workers tend to gender values and under-resourced. There are also allegations of bullying and intimidation, which often don't get reported or, if they do, not rigorously investigated. Greater consultation and communication with employees when the sector is required. This must be conducted in a safe and secure manner that does not expose employees to any negative sentiment. At the same time, absenteeism is a huge concern, and I try to respond to questions of this house the extent of the absenteeism in our public health sector, together with the reasons for the absenteeism too. Unfortunately, I have not been able to study any statistics in relation to this, because the government don't adequately harvest any data. However, absenteeism is a costly affair, with students cover running into the millions of pounds of substitution allowances in the days of North Brighton Centre. This is a serious matter that must be tackled. The government have not given this the priority it deserves. In the Principal Auditor's Report from 2016, the Principal Auditor highlights the mismanagement and lack of control in the GHA with regard to sick and annual leave records. This goes to the very heart of why we need these services, not just the service units, but for the government as an employer too. The Principal Auditor has also given examples of leave records that have been disclosed for a month in some cases. He has also highlighted approximately 24% of records examined as inactive. This is worth investigating and managing. We have the technological advices at our fingertips to turn this around, but it's certainly not doing anything about it. Mr. Speaker, I would like to take this opportunity to thank the Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice, Mr. Bester. He has opened the doors to the Ministry and made available senior officials in the past particular cases and issues. I applaud his non-partisan approach when dealing with matters brought to his attention. With the proposed budget for this financial year of £158 million, questions about the GHA's efficiency and value for money need to be made, and I do trust that the Minister is very thoroughly looking into it. It certainly can be said that our GHA is not limited when it comes to funding, and long may it continue with this process. But there are systematic problems in our health service, which means the investment has not trickled down to the relevant services. The GHA is to be commended for the number of surgical and non-surgical procedures it undertakes. The Minister should be rightly proud of his legacy in this area, which he has fought hard to achieve. However, the breakdown in communication systems internally and with patients is a gap that needs to be addressed. The proper filing of records and ability to locate files promptly are critical matters which must be addressed too. Additionally, the need to repatriate services has never been more central than it is now, with the backdrop of crisis and the challenges this may bring. Whilst I appreciate that the government has been focused on this issue, evidenced by the record-breaking 19.4 million spent on payments in 2016-17 to 1.4 million spent in the last financial year. However, the increase in this year's forecast of 14 million sends mixed signals as the intention of the government moving forward. Mr. Speaker, I have the outer government to provide details related to contracts entered into with health providers. It may be standard information contracts that pass the ritual, may be promotionally sensitive, such as itemized value of specific services. However, there can be certain information which can be made public. I therefore repeat my plea to the government to respond on what has been a reasonable and legitimate question, that is, the overall value of the contract, whether fees are payable, the basis or a flat monthly fee, or a combination of both, the commencement and expectations during the contract, the number of patients currently received in care at each certain centres, and the expected number of patients expected in the future under these agreements. And finally, what aftercare patient support procedures are in place. I would be grateful for clarification as to why the increase in the forecast for the current financial year to 40 million with regard to consultations. Despite the huge budget in our health system, we are still dependent on certain centers for primary, cardiac, and neurology care. This surely must become a priority for our short-term future. I call on the Minister to continue to consider employing full-time specialists in these areas locally. We welcome the Minister's achievement in securing access to pharmaceuticals at the best prices via the NHS Plus framework in 2 years' time, and the exceptional interim procedure for pharmaceuticals via NHS Plus. This will no doubt result in a positive cost reduction for the taxpayer. Mr. Speaker, I would also like clarification regarding the rental contract entered into the new private care centre and the new pediatric centre. We know the rental cost will exceed the property within per year, but how much has the actual expenditure for the cost? What has happened to the new building for the new ambulance and the new MRI supposedly catered for in last year's estimate, alongside the new primary care centre and pediatric centre? And finally, what would happen if government zones promptly better located become available as a future and wish to consider moving the facilities of the primary care centre and pediatric to a government-owned company, property rather? What are the arrangements regarding the buildings built on rented land paid by the taxpayer? Now, moving to the primary care centre appointment system, I must say that the system finally seems to be working better, and the investment of £75,000 is certainly money well spent. I commend the Minister and his team in this regard. The feedback I received is generally positive, however, there is need for an online system that tracks back the time to book appointments with specific doctors. There is also a need to prioritize appointments with specific doctors for persons with disabilities and persons with recurring illnesses. I hugely welcome the forthcoming training for persons up to the age of 18 with disabilities or services that transition to new buildings. However, additional needs have no age, and a bespoke service should be obtained for those who require greater support regardless of age. Since my first entry to this house, I have been calling for greater measures for carers. It gave me great pleasure to hear this news to recognize the size of changes in our economy that carers are. We must commit as a House to recognise carers for long countrymen, but to look into proper policies to take into account training, rest, by additional support, and as carers allowance. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to another area of my responsibility, the elderly. It is no secret that we have an aging population. As such, we have a duty to ensure that we care for the most vulnerable in our society, but crucially, we must also ensure that we can protect the benefits that our elderly enjoy for future generations. Planning the future health and care services of an aging population is a reality. Financial investment is crucial. We must develop a sustainable public policy which ensures a dignified and high level of care for generations to come, whether persons are affected by low mobility or are living with dementia. Mr. Speaker, we in the GSP strongly believe there is a need to create a sustainable elderly care system, where funds are being spent to ensure appropriate health and care services for the future. If elected, the GSP is committed to this. That is to say, Mr. Speaker, the work for today prepare to finance their own care of tomorrow. Additionally, Mr. Speaker, the government should be promoting and facilitating community building initiatives, especially those done to support the most vulnerable in our society. As an example, it is unacceptable that the CAS, the Gibraltar Environment and Dementia Society, were given notice by the Housing Department to vacate the defending the house by a letter with no consultation. We owe a debt of gratitude to the society, across our Tennessee fundraising and carrying those funds into areas that can help the service provided to service users. I therefore fail to understand how the common room at Business Agenda, used by the Society, was developed. The Society hosted supportive meetings and created the field to describe this amongst other things, which was designed to help those living with dementia and their families. Mr. Speaker, I hope this can be resolved urgently and commend the good work done by CAS for the most vulnerable in our community. Moving on to elderly housing, the government recently announced they will be building more specific, specially built accommodation for the elderly. The GST started this as a creative of such and life changing policy for our elderly. We are supposed to welcome the announcement. We welcome the announcement of today from the Minister to include elderly persons who live in private accommodations. However, we can confirm that we believe in means testing as part of our means testing policy, the eligibility criteria to reside in one of the current or future elderly government rentals that be extended to those who live in private accommodations. In the future, this would allow elderly individuals who currently own a private accommodation and own a private accommodation to pay a substantial means tested amount to rent or purchase into a government specially built accommodation. Additionally, Mr. Speaker, the sale and play program during the summer project seems successful for the period of time. However, we as the GST, for reasons already expressed publicly, believe that it should run to the Friday before school commences. But also, Mr. Speaker, that this sort of initiative should be extended to the elderly to keep the community engaged and motivated throughout the year. Finally, Mr. Speaker, the government has accepted the principle to reduce supply workers as much as possible. My concern is always one basis on community care, whilst appreciating the balancing act when bringing costs into account. Last year, when the government decided to close rising care housing for Maple Spring and award the future care contract to Meadow, it was welcome to note that the majority of employees were transferred from one provider to another. However, I shall be asking the government for an explanation at the local stage as to why the estimated appropriations for last year of 1.1 million has resulted in 1.8 million, and it is expected to grow as well as 2.3 million. To the speaker, I now turn to the youth. I must pay tribute to the dedicated youth workers in our community. They are truly vocational and make the most of the resources available to inspire our younger communities. The investment in cancer is also to be welcomed. Together with the work done by the extraordinary professional team, this is now transcending into our schools and the positive effects are remarkable. Yes, we must find ways to get children away from their screens, interacting and developing their skills. The long lost cinema is the start of a fantastic community event. I urge the government last year to bring this back, whether it be at a May Day, an air theatre, or a charity venue. It makes sense from a family point of view, but also from a tourism point of view. Perhaps the basis of culture can enlighten me today with an announcement with this regard. Mr. Speaker, I welcome the regulation on sales with regard to energy drinks. Despite not having any information to do anything about this back in September 2017, I am glad the government had a change of heart. However, Mr. Speaker, it is important to be consistent in approach. If the government is serious about introducing measures to promote children's health, launching a children's health and active multi-agency program known as STEM, how can they defend approving the conversion of a former South District Post Office as a feature next to large schools? It is indeed, Mr. Speaker, the lack of present policies from government taxes are demonstrable. Indeed, the same can be said for the options available in public facilities around the world, in vending machines and hospitals, not just for our children, but our others too. Drawing particular attention to the amount of services available at the social views. Moving to another area of my responsibility, family. Later this week, I shall be publishing an opinion piece based on the proposed reform on parental leave. An attempt not to just equalize the gender pay gap, but also to narrow the gap between the private and public sector. Mr. Speaker, one thing I would like to bring to your attention of the House is the number of men who come to see me who fall out of the system following the emergency breakdown. We have a duty to support men who often lose out on quality time with their children and finally get themselves in a fortress accommodation facility. I believe women in need assist those men, either when they're able to speak or at the end of the day, they function as a charity for women who have been subjected to domestic violence, not a start with the family of the speaker. I would like to add my perspective on the sale of the city to pay, which is said on affordable housing and assisted affordable housing estate, multiple services, company services, family services, local duties, services, and most type of needs. If the government has raised the 165 million, which is to be used to fund the new affordable services project, why is it that persons are being asked to pass for substantial monthly payments beforehand, which would be equal or higher than the future mortgage payments? Why not means set those monthly payments instead? And why for the issue of affordable housing, Mr. Speaker, what is happening with our imaginative design? The school and the new population is literally not the same. Where is our diverse talent and vision in architecture? Mr. Speaker, I am also seeing certain issues. Another extremely important area of my shadow responsibility. I must say my disappointment at the Chief Minister for not addressing this area within his budget of work. It does not otherwise from a perspective point of view. In a 4-hour speech, Chief Minister tried to forget or conveniently forget to include a reference to the drug into the falling, to say the least. Not one word on policy, on future, on how the government intends to tackle the problems we have ahead. Over the recent months, there has been considerable amount of public debate on drugs. In the speaker, the GST has a track record and was a pioneer in the area of addiction and rehabilitation. In particular, former GST Minister Hubert Corby and the Bruce Fund Trust employees. This is lamentable that the project has not changed much in the past 8 years, other than by diminishing the number of sites offered. We have committed to providing alternative pathways to training routes based on care, education, and support. To those individuals who are forced with Class A or B drugs that amount to personal use. Depending on the class and quantity of drugs used to increase specifically designed education classes, compulsory attendance at support group meetings, community service, and rehabilitation programs. The same would apply to those who test positive with A&E. Over the past 2 years, we have had more than 500 cases reported at A&E. However, we in the GST believe that there is simply a criminal fallback to these users who do not wish to engage in alternative parties, and that drugs will remain illegal and see criminal substances endorsed. This is our view, and this is what we wish to tackle when it comes to recreational drug users. In addition, we have also set out a wider policy agenda. This includes providing a crisis care and management team for these addicts in the community at times of need. Regarding rehabilitation, we believe that addicts should be rehabilitated from home as much as possible, and that the rehabilitation program should be diversified as much as possible. We would also look to provide a system of seamless transition from prehabilitation to rehabilitation to aftercare. Moreover, we would focus on employment for recovering addicts in the form of supportive internships and increasing aftercare services. This, Mr. Speaker, we need to put an end to the cliché war on drugs with a balanced, measured, and sensible approach that would see law enforcement officers work with drug support workers. I also advocate for tougher sentences for importers and distributors of drugs. It is unfair for anyone to suggest that we lack vision, leadership, or conviction on this. We have set our thesis and started policy measures. We have done our homework and reached out extensively, culminating in a published approach which is based on education, support, and care, with the default position in law remaining illegal by law enforcement officers, which continue to be the first point of reference in order to assess the breach before taking the matter to the court for large quantities or referring persons to drug support workers for personal use. Essentially, a new approach which is the law enforcement officers work with drug support workers in order to achieve the best results in the future. It is important not just as a politician, but as a parent to ensure we all understand, especially our youth, that these actions have serious consequences. And to mitigate those consequences, it is going to require willpower and commitment. I welcome the announcement from the Minister for Justice with regard to the introduction of the new drug counseling services for families and children, together with mandatory drug testing programs in 5 months. To speak of turning to the medicinal cannabis transportation project. Our concerns in this area is that people simply cannot harvest enough cannabis to sustain the local market, let alone export, we would therefore like clarification as to how this would actually work, and whether there is an element of importation before packaging, and importation linked to the process, or how it is that the proposal is intended to work. With regard to the description of unlicensed medicinal products, the GSP position remains that these agreements comply with the provision, and trusted within a well-regulated system of medicinal products. As such, since the drug advisory council in the UK recommended the parameters of the framework moving forward, the GSP remains at least confused and advocated for the order to follow suit based on the professional advice. The GSP is of the position of the opinion that products recommended for ideal conditions are available for the individual discussion of specific patients who are identified by doctors to fall within the category of persons who would benefit from such products via a GPMS prescription service. I now turn to an area, another area of my responsibility that is the form of training. I often meet others who are unable to obtain a political solution to seek political solutions to their employment crisis. These individuals already feel socially marginalized due to mental health illness, disability, criminal history, and or drugs or alcohol addiction. Nevertheless, as a compassionate society, we should be empowering these persons with chances and opportunities, giving them the tools and a fair platform to improve their lives as individuals in an integrated manner. Instead, Mr. Speaker, all the guests in row expect the tools. It makes complete sense from a political perspective as well as from an employer's point of view as to why setting up a supportive incentive program in the voter won't work. A properly implemented policy will stimulate employment, get people into the right employment, and generally assist those who are struggling in this regard. The vision is not a complicated one to visualize. The vision is the responsibility to support the employees. Ask me during the last session, I asked for 5 years with putting through this area. I am more than happy to share this with him. Firstly, we must offer employers and associated staff with a continued support and structure to deal with challenges they may have to overcome in order to provide the necessary assurances to all parties involved. Secondly, by officially launching a supportive internship program, this would allow employers to boast their acceptance status as an inclusive employer, sharing with the community and their business to themselves their participation in a worthy internship program as well as inspiring other employers to sign up too. Finally, the benefits for the intern are fantastic. The boost in confidence, social inclusion, and motivation will manifest in healthier, contributing individuals with relevant associated health benefits in 2022. There is no need to reinvent the wheel. The European Union for Supporting Employment already have underpinning values and principles to assist us in policy making in how to develop our own policies. But nothing can happen if we do not invest in this project. Establish a dedicated team of professionals and a clear criteria for the team to work on. There is nothing important. There is an important demographic in our community who must be listened to. Their issues may not be headline grabbing or fashionable, which is why we have a greater duty to bring their needs to the fore. We must focus on the real issues affecting people on a day-to-day and let them play to the apparent matters. The electoral calculation of first action must be part of our issue. We have many seminars in various locations, but no one is tackling a proper system to support the most vulnerable in our community. Why is the government so clearly putting this on this issue? In the world of as the president himself, Mr. Speaker, I was looking at conversation a little more action, please. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to the government. The idea of having a fully fledged digital public service is one that really excites me. It is regrettable that we have lost the trust, in particular in technological advances over the last 10 years, and the increase in trust of having access to the internet, too. No one has chosen it today in not delivering e-services as initially roadmap by the ICRC department in 2015. By 2015, particularly, the impressions of managers should be increasing efficiency and strengthening our public service system. I look forward to becoming measured of the minister for e-services as announced during the summer. The government has spent more than 2.1 million on e-services. I would be grateful for clarification as to whether this expenditure figure has now been exceeded right to feel this with proper and fair processes. However, the Facebook and Audit Firm has highlighted in the value of the money order the disaster that was a contract between the government and the Maverick, costing the taxpayer $1.83 million, not related to the services such schools related to rebranding and internet services. Also, Mr. Speaker, it was highlighted the error of expenditure to the euro of £2,000 with any carbon sales limited and agriculture UK limited. In his report, the principal order to highlight among other concerns, A, poor procurement as a bypass national procurement federal regulation, B, a lack of consultation with government IT and IT departments, and C, potentially even breaching the new procurement process. It appears the government has not learned from their mistakes. That is not to consult closely with the ICOD, given their recent demonstration outside this house. Clearly, they have been completely sidelined by this policy, and I strongly believe it is vital to consult and build on the expertise from within. Mr. Speaker, I am opposed to align myself with the concerns of the Portage Order regarding entertainment expenses claimed by ICS together with motor vehicle expenses and taxes. As concerning as this may be, it is systematic of the urgent need to bring actual government and companies into scrutiny on the default that owes its office. It is a such an effect to highlight these expenses as a drain on the public trust by not being able to tackle wholly owned private companies which are financed by the taxpayers. And whilst on the subject of the good work by the Prince of Wales and the team, when the government goes into being segregated for the Gibraltar audit office to provide us with a more efficient and, I quote, a more efficient and audit office fully independent of government during the first year in office as it was to do in the 2011 election. Where is the benefit, Mr. Speaker? Seems like having the interpretation of ivory is high up on the government's agenda. The need for the new legislation is evidenced by the fact that the principal of the census report in January this year to the past, but we have only received it fairly 2 weeks ago. Last year, during my budget address, I spoke about delegations of Cyprus to Israel and their interventions year on year, regardless of today. I stand by what I said, in that I can see the trust that no libertarians ever want to intentionally jeopardize the future of our nation. More so those who stand for election and have earned the trust and respect of the electors. Therefore, I was happy to hear the Chief Minister say in this House late last year, and I quote, the allegation of assaulted or near bankruptcy has been once thrown from the opposition benches, whether might have been the incumbent to those on this side of the House, whoever might have been the incumbent, without even a change of voice for a year, which when people have changed today. However, the lack of transparency and information regarding how we are expected to repay for this, for example, are schools in the residence. For example, Mr. Speaker, in 1560, it was forecasted that 4.8 million would be spent on refurbishment of the various school projects at the age of many hospitals. It is reported by the principal auditor that it is reported by the principal auditor that this expenditure was transferred from the IMDS to a government owned company as a result of the financial deficit. Similarly, the government received a payment of 13.9 million from the government owned company in respect of work previously paid for by the IMDS. These are clear transactions to the benefit of government, which accumulate almost £19 million. The government can argue that school establishments are linked to sale of property, either dispositions for the school buildings or new parking spaces. But this is not excuse the government for not incorporating the revenue and expenditure of these projects to the estimate score. As on the topic of schools, I must make reference to the unprioritized areas in Marshall School, promised to parents by May 2017, and only just been worked from a previously. I am sure it will look very successful, but the fact that it has not been prioritized despite the primary project development of the partner and completion is suggestive. Additionally, I would be grateful if the government could provide details regarding a sound land sold for £15 million in 1516. Given this trade is a substantial amount of revenue for the government, and we have asked the government before in this house. This amount is highlighted by the principal auditor, and I think it is only just right that we've received clarification as to what that transaction is. Mr. Speaker, I, as well as my colleagues on this side of the house, have demonstrated to hold that it is not as well as in the government's system. If you go into the online presentation of the budget, you will simply find the cost of the budget, but no details as to how how they will be funded, and more importantly, how they will be repaid by their communities. The debate in our public finances should be one based on policies. As projects go up, we should know how they're being paid and how they are going to be financed in the future. There has to be a recalibration away from different deliver programs. If you spend £95 million on a new energy plan, that means the relevant revenue source to cover that expenditure. Let's not pretend that electricity prices don't have to go up, and the government should continue to subsidize consumption to the extent that it does. It's not just from an environmental angle, but from a fiscal angle too. Be clear with people of what is expected from them in return. That is the way the Jewish way of doing things. There was no fear as to whether our public spending was too high. We had every faith in the hands of the people that run us. If you're going to boast about ideas and spending value for money, don't spend £40 million on planning for a basis of building those more than 50 years ago. But you know that you can build better quality homes for a customer or so. Let's have a long-term vision in how we do things and develop our lives for the next generation. I have tried to be as balanced as possible in delivering my address, closing the gap where credit is due and holding into account highlighting goals and areas where, quite frankly, more needs to be done and where things could have been done better. But one thing is certain, Mr. Speaker, despite the political differences, despite the dialogue at this time, I know that we have more that divides us than divides us. Mr. Speaker, I would like to thank you, the clerk, and his team for the hard work they do, and wish you all the very best in preparing for the next election. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Stephen Renard. Mr. Speaker, this is my 20th budget speech. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'll start my speech by giving a synopsis of what has been achieved over the last year and some things on the intensive in the coming year in relation to my responsibilities as the Minister for Culture, Media, Youth and Sport. I will start with my responsibility for culture. In last year's budget speech, I announced that the government remains firmly committed to the development of culture locally and to exporting our art at an international level. I am delighted to confirm that in line with this policy, that Gibraltar Cultural Services, on behalf of the Ministry for Culture, established a cultural development unit in November 2018. It saw the employment of a full-time cultural development and educational officer. The unit has already been instrumental in introducing training programs for the cultural officers, groups, coaches, performers, administrators, and others involved in the cultural field. It supports educational establishments, the youth service, and other stakeholders. It is developing generic cultural educational programs. It is promoting our art gallery and our public library, among other duties. The unit has been very proactive and has managed to organize art, drama, music, photographic, poetry, creative writing, and social media workshops and courses. It has happened in conjunction with different societies, groups, and companies such as the
Photographic Society, the White House Theater, Red Tech, and many more. The unit has been instrumental in also organizing a theater lighting and sound 3-day course, allowing young people to explore and process as techniques involved in creating lighting to stage. The development unit introduced an art treasure hunt that will be part of this year's summer sports and leisure program, with guides taking groups around. They work also on the second youth art jamboree. Therefore, the development unit has proved to be a great move and a total success story. Mr. Speaker, this year we will see the launch of the Gibraltar Cultural Services Cultural Award to celebrate the best Gibraltar art and culture. This will take a similar form to the GBC Sports Award. It will be an event that will recognize the potential, ability, and talent and achievements of individuals for collective excellence in our cultural community. The award will also support our community's cultural development. The first cultural award will be celebrated on Thursday, the 5th of December, 2019. This year, on behalf of the Ministry for Culture, has organized a great number of events, which range from a cultural art exchange held in January at the Palacio de la Diputación Provincial de Cali. The project Eastern Wind saw 17 local artists presenting their work there. It was led by curator Magda Bellotti with GCS overseeing. The next phase will be in 2020 when the artists from Cali will exhibit here in the Gustavo Vacarista Gallery. The Gibraltar Berlin Art Residency Project took place for a third year in July 2018. This was Gibraltar artists taking up the art residency in Berlin and a Berlin artist doing a residency in Gibraltar. A book and exhibition of the residency was launched in October 2018 at the Don Hall. We continue to support the participation of local artists in competitions and exhibitions abroad. Examples of this policy in action are the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition, Work of Clay, and Carl Alger at Lloyd EC3, and Edinburgh Art Fair events, to name but a few. In autumn, we are organizing a cultural art exchange together with the JN Memorial Foundation. This is the first phase of the project that will see artists from Tangier coming to Gibraltar to exhibit their work. All of us give effect to our strategy of exporting culture to the world. Mr. Speaker, this year, GCS has introduced a number of new initiatives with a view to market and promote our art gallery. Working with the tourist board via their visitgibraltar.ci website, the galleries are advertised on a weekly basis using different images. The galleries are also promoted via social media. We have also trained the freehand walking tour guides, so they are now able to introduce galleries as part of their tour itinerary. A recent dedication and open day at the Gemma Gallery and presentation to the public on a new exhibition of work with artwork belonging to the government's art collection are examples of further promotion. We have also opened up one over the world in Gemma to local artists and groups, with a number of successful exhibitions already organized today. More monthly exhibitions are planned for the rest of the year. GCS has been busy organizing the book day, the second new open day, in conjunction with the youth service, a second artisan Christmas market in the Langwell Road Boulevard, with a tourist board at the Litany Festival, the street art museum, with the Ministry for the Environment, the Briefing Cavalcade, and the fifth edition of Good Talk. This year, on behalf of the Ministry, is also running the usual programs, the fair and festivals that they are organizing on an annual basis. This includes the Spring Festival, State Fair for Kids, the Spartan Program, the Board of Fair and National Celebrations, the Universal Celebrations, International Artists Competition, Literary and Poetry Competition, May Day, the Drama Festival, the Christmas Festival of Life, and Classical Concerts, among many others. An important part of the work that GCS has done now for a number of years, together with many other departments, including my own department for youth, is the updating of the cultural organization's register. This is in keeping with the child protection policy as directed by the Child Protection Committee. In the last 6 months, they have ensured that all the groups that have completed or signed up to one of the safeguarding children's tier one courses, and they have processed new groups and are ensuring members are vetted accordingly. We are currently working on an information booklet to inform all cultural organizations as to how they can formally register locally. I will say more on this later, given that this format is replicated in my responsibility for sport and youth. Mr. Speaker, GCS has been leading on the cultural program for the island government. This involves the organization of the following: a major retrospective exhibition jointly with the Gibraltar Chronicle to celebrate Gibraltar's participation in the Iron Games from 1985 to 2017. It will be launched on Tuesday the 18th of June 2019 and will run until after the Iron Games on Saturday the 13th of July. An Iron Games art residency that will be held in Gibraltar from the 23rd of June to the 6th of July. This is organized together with the Kitchen Studio, culminating in an exhibition at the John Martin Store, launching on the 4th of July 2017. Multidisciplinary artists from numerous participating islands will be involved, working together with local artists in a variety of workshops and events. Supporting the Island Games Committee with the opening ceremony. The annual gastronomical festival Calentita will kick-start 2 weeks of events at Casemate Square on the 5th of July. Casemate will be known as Games Square, where summer nights will be held daily from the 6th to the 13th of July, respectively. This will also include some Games Medal ceremony. And organizing a tree planting ceremony during the Games on Wednesday the 10th of July 2019. This year, as part of its contract with the Ministry of Culture, has undertaken work to all its major assets. Many of the rooms of the Matthew Hall have been refurbished. New roofing has also been provided above the changing room. Minister Hall has had the auditorium, entrance lobby, staircase, backstage, and corridor spaces, and a new air conditioning unit has been installed. Other minor areas have also been refurbished. The Tower Garita Gallery, and many premises occupied by clubs and associations have been refurbished, repaired, and painted. GPS has also acquired a number of new artworks, which will be added to the Ministry of Culture Art Collection. Mr. Speaker, I move on to the Gibraltar Academy for Music and Performing Arts. And I welcome the Honourable Member Cassidy's remarks on GAMPA. It is right to remind everybody at this point that the idea of setting up an academy was a manifesto commitment of this UFSP Liberal government. The academy continues to be a success story. In fact, over the last 4 years, GAMPA was so successful that it has grown their premises, outgrown their premises. In September, we moved Gampa to a new premises at 7 Hospital Hill. Extensive work were undertaken in order to modify the premises to their requirements. This building has 12 classrooms of different sizes, as well as storage facilities, a homework room, a boardroom, waiting areas, and a reception area. Gampa currently has over 350 students involved in tuition, both in one-to-one and in group classes. Mr. Speaker, I'm happy to say that Gampa's old premises at 63 Flatmaster Road has been transformed into a studio theatre. The drama fraternity has for very long been asking for more space and room to be able to stage small productions. Gampa has been able to provide an atmospheric venue for small performances by converting the magazine at 63 Flatbushian Road. The new use has fully respected the heritage of the site. It is yet another example of the government carefully converting heritage buildings to a modern use. It is known as the Magazine Studio Theatre. Work for these was funded by Gampa through profits made over the past year. The Magazine Studio Theatre is kitted out with 10 square meter stage, and the light and sound rig, as well as dressing room and waiting bar area. Gampa also purchased a vintage grand piano to be used to entertain the waiting audience. Both of these premises are used daily. Percussion classes and examinations are all held at the Magazine Studio Theatre, which also stages performance every 4 weeks. This includes plays open to the public and private recitals. Mr. Speaker, this year Gampa took on a worldwide program called I Am Me. Their tour to all schools giving self-esteem and character building workshops. They also held fire workshops with all school fires and recorded the I Am Me song featuring all local school fires, as well as recording the video of the song. The aim of this program is to promote a positive message of togetherness and it also works as an anti-bullying campaign. It is a way to reach the younger generation to promote their well-being through a positive message. During 2018, Gampa has been involved in a great number of performances and initiatives, such as offering drama therapy classes for 8 weeks for students with special learning needs and challenges. The Gibraltar Youth Choir, which represented Gibraltar at the World Choir Games in Tiswan, South Africa, obtained third place on the Pop Ensemble. Acting students taking part in the Shakespeare's Kids workshop, organized by UK-based company and GTS. A technical CS course offered to acting students by GTS technician Marco Cess at the Magazine Studio Theatre. Workshops for the instrumentalists in collaboration with the Philharmonic Society. Rina Mangrani participating in the Elena Cobb Women's Concert at the Royal Albert Hall in London. Kids rock the concert. This is an annual Parasol Foundation sponsored Pemberton show held at the Magazine School Theatre, featuring over 200 students from the Academy. These are just a few of the many events that they have organized alone and together with other groups. Mr. Speaker, Gampa continues to work very closely with the Parasol Foundation in order to develop the Parasol Foundation scholarship program. The scholarship awards are for students who show a high level of skill and have potential to excel. Beginners who show potential to have achieved considerable progress in a short space of time. and the ensemble which is open to all students at the academy, in order to be able to develop what is another, the youth orchestra, which is one another of our manifesto commitments. Gamta is very proud in continuing to offer examination opportunities to students to choose to study both classical and rock and pop music, as well as acting and drama. Mr. Speaker, our annual mega concert, now the devoted holy, goes from strength to strength. This was one of our manifesto commitments. It has become an event that has excellent international appeal. Every year we see how many people flock to Gibraltar to enjoy the 2-day festival of music. Our visitors come mainly from the UK. It is great for our economy. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member Mr. Clinton again mentioned the magnificent Gibraltar College. And since that today, we have spent in the region of 11 million. But, as per usual, from him, he forgets about how much direct revenue comes to UOB, which is about 5 million. During the year, it has been running. The value of the festival in bringing people to Gibraltar is ignored by the Honourable Member. And the value of the exposure we get abroad is also ignored. Just as a conservative estimate, the value of bringing people is approximately 200,000 for every concert we have, i.e., 8 concerts, which then equates to 1.6 million. The value of the exposure of the is approximately 500,000 per concert. So this times 8, 4 million. So together, it adds up to 5.6 million. Further, the fact that hotels, restaurants, shops, etc. are employing more people, paying more taxes and social insurance. In fact, it is relevant to hear the Chief Minister and my colleague Mr. Likuri report to the House that all tourism statistics were up and that the hotel occupancy is up. Mr. Speaker, event-led tourism works. We see how artists and bands, social media, to announce that they are coming to Gibraltar. This generates even more publicity to Gibraltar. As an example, Stormzy on Twitter is 1.1 million followers, and last year he tweeted Colombia with the word Gibraltar. Rita Ora has 6.8 million followers, and he too mentioned Gibraltar. I would like to read a short email that was forwarded to me to make precisely the point. The email was from a journalist to the organizers, our organizers. Hi Richard, hope you are well today. I received two of these ORLs, so I wondered if you could facilitate a meeting with someone that works in the tourism PR for Gibraltar. Mira Online would like to run a piece on Gibraltar as a great weekend destination, tagging in Gibraltar Calling. But we need to provide them with a breakdown of the latest concept, restaurants, places to visit, stories, etc. Deadline the 14th of August, and I would like it for that Monday the 13th. Would it be possible for you to connect us with someone that can give us this information? Thank you. Sorry. This free publicity is worth hundreds of thousands of pounds, which would otherwise would have to be spent in marketing Gibraltar. And for boot, it is a festival that nearly everyone in Gibraltar enjoys. So the benefit of continuing the Gibraltar Calling is huge, and therefore we will continue to do so. And now found to my responsibility regarding the media. I am pleased to report that construction of BBC's brand new media centre at South Johnson Bastion is now well underway. The building steel frame has now been virtually completed, with internal work proceeding well too. Technical fit-out is now due to start this coming February, and BBC Television Radio is also expected to start live transmissions from the new venue next summer. The government is very much looking forward to our national broadcaster finally being able to operate from a purpose-built facility that will provide a much more pleasant working environment for BBC employees. The relocation program project continues to be the priority for this year's 40BC management team, who are liaising with expert consultants and service providers on how to extract the highest possible benefits from the new building. The project has its challenges, and it is determining the benefit value of the site while incorporating a new building. It is being designed with an efficient use of all available space. The new broadcasting house will provide an excellent facility for our national broadcaster. While it is being constructed, the life of the current building is being stretched to ensure television and radio programming can continue in the interim. Investment continues on electronic systems that will be relocated next year to South Jumper Bastion, while other end-of-life systems are being carefully maintained by BBC engineers to avoid duplication in costs because they're before being decommissioned. Moving a television and radio station is logistically complex, when one of the major considerations has to be at minimal disruption to the programming. Despite that, plans are well in hand to relocate the facilities in 2020. The past 4 months have seen the expansion of radio services with the introduction of an alternative schedule overnight on Radio Gibraltar Plus, which now carries up to 14 hours a day of additional programming, providing a wider choice for listeners. This has been achieved by maximizing technology and reorganizing assets, always having in mind value for money. Radio Gibraltar has and will continue to ensure that it is always a big part of our community and a strong schedule of programs that are both informative and entertaining with a high level of listener interaction. It achieves this by staging roadshows at events throughout the year and thereby living and breathing Gibraltar through the airwaves. The selection of TV programs offered nowadays by BBC is a far cry from that were on the screen just a few years ago. Since 2013, this government has provided BBC with a much-needed additional resources for them to improve the variety and quality of both its local and international programs. The past 12 years has effectively this with the number of television programs introduced increased. Now we have seen Viewpoint, the Hub, City Scouts, the Powder Room, and the Sports Locker, and they have become the mainstay of studio-based shows. Other new and returning services include in their footsteps, Fortresses of Fortress, the Working History, all of which focus on the waters of its history. There are too many programs to list, but it is worth mentioning that the many outside broadcasts on Christmas and Easter specials that are also produced, as well as the Western Nations League and European qualifier games, and the very successful BBC Sports Awards celebrating achievements of our many sportsmen and women. Being the Minister for the Media and Sports, the event would not be more fitting in the context of the overview of my ministry activity, for which I am delighted that the awards are now a firm fixture of both the broadcasting and sports calendar. The global vibrant economy, the low local political scene, busier than ever social calendar, as well as the ongoing Brexit story, means the GBC team of journalists have been at work for the maximum space to keep Gibraltar informed. GBC has a total and absolute freedom of impartiality, and that is what it is expected from a public service broadcaster when it delivers news reports to the consumer via traditional means of radio and television, as well as through the corporate, very active social media and online platforms. One of the biggest successes of GBC is its long-standing charitable arm, the Open Day Charitable Trust. The community fundraises throughout the year, with all of it coming together on the second Wednesday of December, when Madison radio and television shows are staged. Every event very much brings together everyone together just ahead of the festival season. This year, the all-time fundraising record was broken with a huge £165,000 collected for the local worthy cause. The trust provides funding for special specific projects nominated by local registered charities. The more recent one is that of £75,000 for a first aid unit for the St. John's Ambulance. The trust has also donated £50,000 to the Society for Cancer Relief, £17,000 for the funding of a numerous fitness activity for the elderly organized by the Physical Activities Association for Mansoura, Older Madrid, amongst other, several other donations. Mr. Speaker, there are not many countries, if any, our size, that have the benefit of having our own national television and radio service. It says much about Gibraltar as a mature society while providing a sense of nationhood. GBC has currently 85 professionals at all levels who give their all to ensure that the corporation delivers the best service, including television and radio programs, online content, and daily news coverage. Work on the programming for the next 12 months is already very much in production. This will include coverage of the next month's Gibraltar Iron Games, more live international football, a new series of inspired by that travels to India, this time to focus on Gibraltar's Hindu community, and a second series of a life abroad amongst Mumbai. Broadcasting in Gibraltar is moving forward, with radio, television, online services into the future as a result of the investment into the sector being made by this GSLP Liberal administration. As a Minister for Media, I'm happy to say that there are now a number of other private broadcasting entities in the market. GYTV is running a good service with its online services. Rock Radio has received recently gone on air offering listeners music just for the young, but also for the not so young. Our traditional two-day newspapers, the Gibraltar Chronicle, the Panorama, keep us very much informed of all that is current through the traditional print format. They are also available on social media and online platforms. We also have a number of magazines in the market covering social, cultural, and musical events. This shows that we enjoy a wide variety of events in our social calendar, which are then reported upon and reported by the media in general. Mr. Speaker, the Gibraltar Youth Service continues to open its doors and have created and developed programs that have reached to more young people. It is great to see our community youth workers developing programs designed for youngsters who acquire life skills and at the same time doing all kinds of community and charity work. These programs are the Insight Project, which aims to increase the awareness of young people about the employment and career path that they are able, that are available for freedom. The Devotional Youth Service has been reaching out to government departments and local businesses in order to facilitate an inside experience for young people on what it might be like to work in these places. The Glory started in September 2018, and it provides a safe place for young people during lunch time where they can have a healthy meal prepared by the young people who are gaining experience in catering in the catering business and have undertaken health and hygiene courses. It is open on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. And here, Mr. Speaker, I would like to inform the Honourable Member, Mr. Yana, that there is this program is geared towards what the young people eat, which he has now he commented about how young people are now eating different things. Well, this program is specifically to try and educate and inform young people of what is good to eat or not. And I may add as well that with the absence of what is happening with the environment, there are many, many young people who are now opting to be vegan and to change their lifestyle. So we should take an example of that. And I agree with him on that, because they are giving us a lesson on how we should look after the environment and be healthy at the same time. This program of the Zone on Tuesday also continues in the afternoon, and is further extended to young people who are not in education, employment, or training. And it is open to everyone who requires additional support with employment and life skills. The Mingo is a program that the Youth Service, together with the Care Agency and the Department of Education, have recently embarked on. This is a new community initiative with young adults up to the age of 30 who have or experience mild learning difficulties. This has increased the joint approach amongst organizations that come in contact with vulnerable adults. Again, you mentioned about people not having support and not having the backing when they are unemployed, support employment and all that. Well, this program is actually tackling that. The project is in its infancy, and the Youth Service are very excited about its potential. Jonathan Ryan, this started in October 2018, and has an inclusive community choir initiative where young people of all ages are welcome to attend. Performances are taken at St. Teresa's Church during Christmas, also as a roadshow to various adult services, including St. Bernadette, the elderly residence services, clubhouse, and the community daycare center for adults. The power of music increases social fulfillment, boosts confidence, and reduces anxiety and stress levels. And for this, I'd like to also congratulate the young people, because they do get in contact with their older generation, and it is great to see how they can interact one with the other. This is another program that is introduced by the GSC government, and this is another program that the Youth Service, I am happy to say, are working on really well. This for Birthday House. This started in April, and saw many people and youth take pictures on a drone and donated proceeds to Birthday House. Most of the members of this parliament have done so. Currently, the drone is on tour, continuing to raise funds for the Birthday House. In partnership with SAN and Gibraltar Dyslexia Support Group, two videos were filmed and edited by the GYDC to raise awareness of mental health issues and dyslexia. Again, another example that we are concerned and we do take seriously issues like mental health. Mr. Speaker, as we have seen recently, young people are very keen to make a statement about climate change. Gordy Green is yet another project with the Gibraltar Youth Service study to do. The object is to reduce the environmental impact from the couple and the youth club. Establishing gardening projects, recycling all goods, and using these items in their art and craft sessions are some of the practical effects. They have upholstered older sofas instead of purchasing new ones. They have resourced their soft, eco-friendly cleaning products and continue to recycle their waste. They do not purchase single-use plastic cups and encourage their employees and club members to bring their reusable drink bottles. They participate annually in the Clean Up the World campaign. They are also working with Merlin Games in designing and creating sea model creatures for recycled goods. Clean seas are future. These will be exhibited at the youth club during the week of the 6th to the 12th during the Island Games. What was known as the Gibraltar Youth Council has now changed its name to the Voice of Young People. This group was formed in order for them to highlight issues which concern young people. Today they have created a young person's local directory which features health, leisure, education, general advice, and other support services that young people can use at any given time. They also prepared a questionnaire for teenagers. This was completed by 1,302 young people. The aim was to find out what issues they are facing today. Bullying, mental health, drugs, and underage drinking were the top four. The VYP group have already are working to address these issues and have already met with the chief minister. In these meetings, they informed the chief minister of the work they were doing and how they intended to progress. They have also met with Minister Bocet and officials from the Department of Education to see how bullying was being tackled to influence current policy. They have also been instrumental in highlighting the issues of teenage mental health. To this end, they have seen how the health service is leading more and learned how they will be there will be a health counselor soon in school to be able to deal with these issues at an early stage. They will be meeting soon with the RDP to highlight the issue of drugs and underage drinking, which was a concern high on their agenda. All in all, this group has been very proactive, and the youth service will continue to work with them to highlight the priorities of young people. Youth Day 2019 is also a joint event with the Gibraltar Council of Service. This year, a Youth Day committee was formed comprising of young people, representing various youth organizations. The committee has had the opportunity to debate, to decide on all matters concerning the youth day. Their responsibility for delivering youth day ranged from choosing a date and the venue to email administration, promotion of events, and working during the event itself. The experience the organizers have gained was immense, and it will serve them well in the future. Bikeability is a partnership program with the Ministry of Transport. One of our youth and community workers will be training professionally in the UK to teach cycling skills to autistic children. Lastly, I would like to mention the participation of the youth service on our January 2019 cavalcade float. This year, the float supported and promoted the Island Games. The youth service continues to participate in further professional development, for example, managing challenging behavior in the course that the staff have recently attended. The youth service is now a vibrant, proactive service which continues to form part and contribute to various multi-agency forums. They are represented on the Child Protection Committee and Staff Training Committee, Drug Advisory Council, the Youth Advisory Council, the Trans Children, Healthy and Active Multi-Agency Program Institute. The Laguna Youth Club, Dolphin Youth Club, and the Plata Youth Club continue to open their doors to a younger age group of children from 7 to 14. They have developed a debating process. This is one way for young children to research, learn, develop, and their knowledge, and most importantly, to be confident when speaking in front of an audience. They have been developing their employability and problem-solving skills from the planning and fundraising of educational trips to programs, which will include a visit to houses. As a result of the success of the work done by the youth club and the increase in numbers coming to the club, more support workers have been called in for these sessions. The youth service is now well positioned to continue with the great work they do for young people, going forward into the future. Mr. Speaker, I will now move to my responsibility as the Minister for Sport and Leisure. And I will start with King Castle Leisure Centre. In the King Castle Leisure Centre, there have been a number of major projects carried out during the last year. One of these projects involved the installation of a fan card system. This system has replaced the POS station at the bowling alley, ice rink, fitness gym, and reception. This meant the installation of card issuing kiosks in the bowling and fitness gym areas, and the addition of card readers, four arcade machines, with extensive cabling required throughout the center to connect all equipment to the server. With this fan card system, users are able to put money into the card, which they can then use for any of the activities in the leisure center, excluding the cinema and the restaurant. The benefit to the center is that it removes the cumbersome task of cash handling, particularly the coins from the arcade. This potentially will result in an increase in revenue of about 15%, which will help to offset against the cost of installing the system. All the wood paneling beneath the carpet in the right, in the cinema on the right screen, and in the kitchenette, which was suffering from severe dampness, were all replaced. New mirrors were installed in the fitness gym, and one of the ice compressors in the chiller pit became faulty and also had to be replaced. The amusement arcade, three new gaming machines have been added. A thorough inspection of the ceiling of the bowling alley concluded that extensive refurbishment work has to be carried out ahead of its refurbishment. The ice rink had been leaking for some time. These works meant the closure of the rink for a few months. Now this has been repaired. The center embarked on a critical project planned for this year. The previous bowling alley, which was scaled as the state of the park when it opened in 2008 on the watch of the people on the other side, was actually a second-hand system which was already 15 years old before it was built in the King Fashion Leisure Center. So much for value for money. Therefore, it was not fit. It was not in a fit state to bear the rigors of the Iron Games taking place next month. I am happy to say that this has now been completed, replaced by a brand new bowling lane, a new scoring system, and a new mechanical equipment. This is now up and running, and our bowlers have been able to train there in preparation for the games next month. And thank you, Mr. Speaker, I am on the item of the King Fashion Leisure Centre. An honourable member mentioned about the cinema in outside, which was a great success, which I totally agree with. There are already moves to see whether the other parts that have been done can have a place where much goes can be done, and therefore, and my honourable member from here confirms that, that there will be a place where a screen can be placed and shows of cinema can be done. So, again, the theatre can be both delivering. I mean, all the members are very much aware we will certainly be hosting the 18th edition of the NatWest International Hour Games. The opening ceremony scheduled on the 6th of July marks the start of what will be a week of great sporting competition. Gibraltar and the other 23 territories will battle it out for medals. It will also be the culmination of 4 years of extremely hard work by a large cross-section of the community. This opportunity presented itself to host the Iron Games while in Germany in 2015, I have seen the local sporting fraternity pulled together in a way only the Rotarians can. The work undertaken by those involved in the Games, together with the assistance offered by many other sectors of the community, means that the voter will no doubt host a truly memorable week. I would like to place on record my personal faith and that of the government to all those who have worked tirelessly to make the Games a success, many of whom have done so on a voluntary basis. I will not name them as there are too many to mention, and I do not want to omit any individual or entity from the list. We are now at the point where these games are very much in reality and will be the greatest biggest sporting event to date. The journey has not been an easy one. No one expected it to be. I think we need to be reminded that some 2,500 visitors will descend on the rock for approximately 10 days, with this figure including athletes, officials, team members, press, that will come to cover the games. Images and reports of our countries will be sent back to their respective islands. The importance of the positive exposure cannot be underestimated. I can mention, as I mentioned earlier, that the Iron Games will feature a full and varied cultural program. I urge everyone to support the Games, to be by supporting in Gibraltar at a different venue and by engaging with our visitors on our famous Gibraltarian hospitality. At this juncture, I am pleased to announce that the Iron Games expenditure will be in keeping with what was submitted in the original bid document. In the last financial year, the current expenditure on the Iron Games subhead has been reconciled to 1.52097 million, and with the revenue totaling 212,500. For the coming financial year, this expenditure, which should be finalized by September, is projected to amount to 894,475, with revenue projected of 1.3 million for 4,500. When analyzing both expenditure and revenue over both financial years, the net cost of HMG is 818,445. This is in fact less than the 1 million that was originally estimated, which is great news. The price of the game will result in visitors eating in local restaurants, staying in local hotels, spending in local shops, while enjoying our tourist sites and everything else we both have to offer for a full 10 days will bring approximately 3 million to the economy in general. It is also important to remember that apart from the legacy that the games will leave, the figure I have just quoted includes expenditure in many other smaller but crucial legacy items which our sports people will be able to benefit for a long, very long time. The country's long tennis club and the multi-use games area based by complex have benefited from the resurfacing program that that will be at Bayside Sports Complex, in particular to be utilized by communities in general. The spectators' experience at the Turf and Injury Sports Hall has been greatly improved by the installation of glass panels in the stand, making the entire entirety of playing area visible in the respective way you are set to see. Wilson's magazine is currently undertaking a repair and refurbishment program that will make it an iconic venue for the pistol shooting event during the game, and will make the changes available for use as a controlled manner, not only for us to vote a picture of the season, but to others also test the game. These changes were lying on me, and after extensive consultations with all relevant stakeholders, and with input from the Development Planning Commission, the Heritage Trust, the Department of the Environment, and others, they have been revised and will be renewed. Of the 200 bespoke barriers have been purchased for the road events, mainly the cycling and the triathlon. These will be available for future sporting events, and there are leases that will be used for other cultural events such as the cavalcade. As a final point under this item, we must also consider all the equipment that that are registered sports associations involved with the game have received. This will help them develop their respective sports and contribute to raise standards when we compete at an international level. The hosting of the Island Games has been the main focus this year. However, we both have continued to organize and host numerous events, many of which form an integral part of our annual calendar for international celebrations. The expenditure in this respect has totaled nearly 1.3 million. These international events have a real value in publicity terms, and this respect will also provide exposure on major sporting television networks during prime time slots, as is the case of the Pool, Stars, and Super event. Still local hotels during quiet off-peak periods of the year, as it has done with the Chess Festival, which continues to grow in strength and reputation, and is revered the world over. To maintain our sporting fraternity practice at an international level, with many of the organizational models employed locally now serving as templates for other host countries, it is worth to continue to attract them to Gibraltar. Investment tourism has always been the policy of this GSOP liberal administration. And I said before, it's working. And this I am about to provide is a testament of this. Over the last financial year, the government has, via the GSOP, supported being involved in or directly organized the World Snooker Gibraltar Open, PDC Darts, World Food, International Chess, 8 International Junior Chess, European Backgammon events, which pick up on all these I have in my speech, how much each of them is the value, but I won't go through them, but I'll just take one, which is the one that I use as an example of a low overlap, and I think it's exactly every year, which is the International Chess, which attracts 400 persons times 400 nights, 400 persons at 11 nights, is 2,000 dead nights in the world. And when you multiply that by at least 120 pounds, which is what people are averagely spend on a night, including the hotel bed, one can work out how much the whole of the thing brings to our coffers. So the people they are, the Gibraltar Sports Open, the Table Soccer World Cup, and other great success, 400 people for an 11-day event. So there's a lot more in the future, but I'm kind of sure and say that the value to our economy of hosting all these events in Gibraltar is as follows.
being given, had a total of 15,225 bed nights, an approximate 8 plus, which are other additional small tournaments which are not in this list, equates to another 2,700 bed nights for tournaments mentioned, and therefore we have total in 17,925 bed nights. For each bed night, it is now considered to be worth £120 per bed night, including general expenditure by visitors for being hotels, food, beverages, amenities, tourist attractions, and shopping. The value to the economy is more than double the expenditure. This does not include daily visitors, and all those who come to the event independently. The DSLA has also assisted the Gibraltar Football Association with the hosting of the Champions League and the Europa League qualifiers last summer. It has also been an integral part of ensuring that our national teams once again play official UEFA matches at the historic stadium. The main site called Complex, the multi-use games area, commonly known as MUGA, is a hive of activity during dry, good and dry weather, but fails power in inclement weather. We have therefore decided to convert it into a semi-rigid covered area. Work will start after the game since the area has been prepared to host the 10 matches during the game. Mr. Speaker, sport plays a vital role in our society. We host many events. We take up time from the local use of our existing facilities. For all our 42 registered sports associations have continued to organize and complete their respective seasons. It has been a testing year, and I would like to thank all those that have been affected for working so closely with the Ministry of Sport and the GSLA to try to maintain normality as much as reasonably possible. Our sports people have understood the magnitude of the island games. More importantly, they have seen the benefits of the new infrastructure project that we will be providing. Their cooperation has been instrumental in allowing the project team and the GSLA to fulfill their responsibilities. HNDOG's financial support for our local sporting facilities has been unwavering. We will continue to support our sportsmen and women. A total of 621,000 has been provided via the Gibraltar Sports Advisory Council. Mr. Speaker, the previous administration advised in 2011 to spend a total of 516 on grants to sports associations, international competitions, sports development programs, and including the hosting of special sports and leisure events. We have currently budgeted for this year a total of 635 for grants to sports associations, international competitions, and sports development programs, excluding hosting of special sports and leisure events. I repeat, excluding the hosting of sports and leisure events. The hosting of sports and leisure events is shown on the estimate book as a separate item, is an additional £1 million. This shows that not only are we providing events which the community enjoys, as I mentioned above, we are also investing in our sports association in order to host many events here in Gibraltar. This brings all the benefits to our economy, and as I have described earlier. These events have only been possible after GISA, which is made up of volunteers, representatives sponsored by the associations themselves, sits through every single application and applies the set criteria. These individuals give up of their free time and can become very long meetings and are a vital cog into both supporting the community. My thanks to them also. Mr. Speaker, in order for these associations to receive financial or logistical support, they have to meet certain criteria at the point of annual registration. As members will be aware, this year's Liberal administration set up the Child Protection Committee, with representatives from the DFLA sitting in the executive committee as well as various subcommittees. It is therefore logical that child protection policies and safeguarding criteria form an integral part of the registration process for sporting and leisure entities. With this in mind, the DFLA Sports Development Unit has rolled out an extensive training program that has meant that in this last financial year, 117 coaches and or individuals who dealt and deal with children and many young people have received safeguarding training delivered by the DFLA. This means a total since November 2017 at over 350 if we add to these all those coaches and who receive safeguarding training via their own sports specific coaching education. Huge strides have been made to ensure a safer environment for those involved in sports and leisure. The period of grace for the submission of adequate child protection policies has also elapsed. I'm glad to report that the vast majority of the registered sports associations have already submitted finalized versions, while those that have not, we are working closely with the DFLA to finalize them. While dealing with the participation of children in sports and leisure, I would like now to move on to the summer sports and stay and play program. The summer sports and leisure program 2018 once again improved on its various years' attendance. 540 children were registered with the main arm of the program, namely the sports train and stay and play program. Amazingly, repeated attendance totaled 10,000 units over 6 weeks. 1 unit is equal to one child attending one session. The sports train offers sporting and leadership activities for 7 to 14 year olds every weekday morning. The children's corner offers appropriate sports and recreational activities 3 days a week for years 5 and 6. Family evening sessions noticed a marked improvement in attendance, with sessions attracting groups of an average of 45 people and 90 plus on some occasions. Speaker, the stay and play program offers sports, physical, art, and leisure activities for children with disabilities 5 days a week. This element is particularly needed. This element in particular needed to review its schedule, given the significantly higher attendance. With this in mind, the temporary staff complement has been increased for an upcoming program. In addition, the care agency was actively involved in the induction training program for 2018, adding the quality of delivery while safeguarding the interests of leaders and children alike. There was a need to call upon the services of Murdoch, during the program, the availability of those on the supply list did not meet the ratio for the service leaders attending. Mr. Speaker, due to the hard work of those involved with the Stay and Play program and its success, I am happy to announce that the purpose-built premises at the Volkshaus will be extended this financial year to accommodate the high demand of children attending. This is a far cry from the days before 2011, when the Stay and Play program was conducted in a small unit in the Volkshaus. The DFLA, together with the government department, have provided 20 sports associations and leisure associations and leverage providers with a range of sports, coaching courses, and take professions for children and young people.
Healthcare is an extremely dynamic industry, and the information I provided shows that the Ministry for Sport and all its components are certainly in tune with what is required and are providing the community with the service, support, and facilities that they require but most importantly deserve. Therefore, it is only right to invest in sport. Last year, in my budget speech, I said that never in the history of Gibraltar has a government invested so much time and effort in sporting projects than the GSLP's Liberal government. How true it is, and we will be seeing the fruits of this investment in the coming weeks and months as we roll out the completion of the work. Therefore, I will not now go over or mention all the new facilities we have built. I will allow the general public to judge for themselves. Last year, I also asked the people to be patient in the final year before the game. I would like to thank the whole of the population for allowing us to work for you. Thanks also goes to the sporting associations who have endured disruption in their training schedules or venues. It's an honor to have been able to deliver facilities which will be there for many years to come. Many of the events that were mentioned above will once again be part of our calendar. Given that Gibraltar is now enjoying new and improved sporting facilities, we are actively working to try and attract more international events to Gibraltar. Each option is being studied with a value for money and international exposure in mind. This is the main criteria that must fulfill before contracts are signed or commitments are given. The new facility will allow us to develop our sports industry. And the sky is the limit, Mr. Speaker. With our wonderful facilities, we will be in a position to attract clubs, schools, national teams of all levels coming to Gibraltar to compete with our athletes and or through their training routine. Therefore, the government will be engaging our sporting fraternity to host more international events. We have seen how our towns are filled up. It is good to see new hotel projects going up and increase capacity to Gibraltar by air. This is a reflection of our exposure, the exposure that Gibraltar has received. It is also the result of working closely with the tourist board, who have also market our events abroad. The plethora of new sporting venues will be worth every single penny spent. More venues will also mean that our local competitions and development programs will be able to continue with hardly any disruption, if any at all. The GFLA will now have more options through the use of alternative facilities instead of having to postpone or cancel the existence of training programs. All in all, a win-win situation, which has only happened as a result of the GSLP Liberal vision and our unprecedented investment in sport. The sports industry may well become another pillar of our economy, and we will succeed, Brexit or no Brexit. Mr. Speaker, I would like to close my address this year by saying thank you. Great. I'm glad you're all listening. It's great to see that I'm enjoying my speech and listening. But while the others were saying that everybody went out to the house. Never mind. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Great to the staff of the Gibraltar Cultural Services at the Gibraltar Academy of Music, Performance and Art, as the Leisure Management Services for the King's Doctor in the Centre, as the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority, at GBC, at the Youth Service. I would like to thank all members of the Youth Advisory for their patients, all those who have made in any way affected, sorry, all those who have been in any way affected by the works that have been taking place, and to the general public who are or have endured inconvenience, such as road closures or diversions, I am convinced that they will understand the importance of the game, and that next month we will be even more understanding when the beginnings are actually on. Thank you for allowing us to work for you. Thank you also to the members of all the governing bodies of those sports who are and have been involved in delivering the state-of-the-art facility, which will leave a lasting legacy well after the Iron Games has passed. I am extremely grateful to the organizing committee of the Iron Games, most of whom do this without any financial interest. However, I must single out one person for a special thank you, and that person is Linda Alvarez. Linda's leadership has been truly exemplary throughout the process. To all the volunteers in the committee, and all those who have put their names down to be ambassadors of our proud country, the team at APS and Ophelia that have and are producing all the architectural and technical design of all the sporting and cultural projects that I am involved in. Thanks to the contractors, Kasai, for the wonderful student accommodation that are completed on budget and on time. To GJBS, all its workforce and all the workers from the subcontractors who have worked round the clock. Thanks to those of the technical service department and the chief technical officer who has for their invaluable input to the project. Thanks to the financial secretary who has given me direction related to funding. LPS for their advice and guidance related to non-business. Thanks to all the essential services who have worked with the organizing committee for the games. Thank you to you and your staff, Mr. Speaker, and the staff of Parliament, and last and definitely not least, myself at the Ministry of Culture, Media, Youth and Sport at the City Hall. Without them, I would not be able to have implemented all the positive policies and manifest the commitments which I am involved. They have definitely been my right hand. Thank you to all. Membership is the right for me. legitimately raised.
The fact that the EU position also wishes to promote the Cyprus Association already back in the ongoing establishment and upgrading of its own national status. It is particularly gratifying to see the Cyprus Association almost full to capacity whenever our national team play a home game. The home venue thereby gives the Cyprus Stadium as a home the ground, albeit with necessary upgrades undertaken, was a location first promoted by the EUC. It seems that where there is a will, there is a way, and therefore the EUC has proved it is not wrong from the outset in choosing the Victoria Stadium as the best site for an UEFA and FIFA fully approved facility. It is indeed a far more viable and effective option for local sports lovers to attend and support our team, who will be playing the qualifying home matches for the season 2019-2020 in respect of the Europa League qualification. I am sure this house is unanimous in wishing our teams participating within the Europa League all the best in the forthcoming games. The Europa team and St. Joseph's team have everything to play for in the imminent games in order to obtain qualification on the next stage of the international European competition. And I hope that stadium is full to capacity as we know we can do. We also wish the best of the Bulgarian left to look from the Rams FC for the forthcoming Champions League qualifying game. Despite their game being played away from the Volta this year, I'm certain football lovers will still be equally as proud and supportive of our national representatives. The forthcoming development of Victoria Stadium are resulting in an improvement to football facilities in Gibraltar. However, despite the fantastic and ambitious project to be undertaken by the GSA, there is still a great need for further training facilities with our future generations how to aspire to improving their overall standards. It continues to break my heart to see so many Gibraltar registered football teams having to go over to Spain in order to train in preparation for local and international matches. Indeed, more facilities are very much needed if we are to continue to aspire progressing beyond the qualification stages in respect of European Champions League and the Europa League. The GSA continues to believe that alongside these new facilities, which will soon be enjoyed by the football fraternity, there is still a great need for extensive training facilities in Gibraltar to cater for participants in numerous sports. These facilities should ensure that the introduction and development of our youngsters into the world of sports, the lessons arising from our school curriculum and sporting clubs' commitment, are equally catered for. It is the duty of the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority to make these facilities available for a general public at large in which to participate in sporting activities. The new facilities, which have been constructed in connection with the Island Games, should ensure to some extent that the Gibraltar continues to produce worthy local athletes and develop a wide range of sporting talent. We often have results which make our members and our sporting opponents in a basic competition subject of a rather good and consistent result. I sincerely hope that the new construction will meet local requirements well beyond the Island Games themselves. Indeed, many Gibraltarians are currently having involved in carefully planned training sessions with aspirations of proudly representing Gibraltar at the 2019 Island Games, which will, for the second time in the game history, be held in Gibraltar. I am sure I speak for the whole house as we offer our collective best wishes to all forthcoming participants who, through their committed efforts, will hopefully yet again make us proud of our sporting fraternity. Those new facilities which have been completed are so far looking good.
therefore, I wish to record my apologies for being absent at next week's reception to be hosted by His Worship the Mayor, where we will be paying special tribute to recent successes attained by our electoral representatives. Also being such a grammar at the Mayor's reception, with being our evergreen over 16 football teams and the promising youngster Sebastian De Souza, who participates within a top competitive world of golf. The age range of both men and both women being recognized by his worship shows that in Gibraltar, participation in sports is enjoyed by all irrespective of age. Given recent results, such as those I have highlighted, together with many others, let's take for example Special Olympics, it seems we have justifiable expectations for each year's notable achievements for the forthcoming 2019-2020 season. If you speak over your leave, I would like to repeat the offer I made last year, as well as the year before that, during this public contribution. Although I am a firm believer that individual sports governing bodies should be allowed to manage their own affairs with no political interference, I once again urge the Minister for Sport, more so in his capacity as chairman of the Sports and Leisure Authority, to take a particular interest and take appropriate action to ensure that publicly owned facilities are used in a fair manner for the benefit of all sports lovers. There is both a duty and obligation from the sports authority to ensure, where desired by a club or individual citizen, membership in the relevant local governing body is open to all in an equal and fair manner. I would again offer myself to sit down and discuss with the Minister for Sport possible avenues which may be looked into in order to set up a special independent body tasked with matters pertaining to and requiring arbitration relating local sports issues. Some disputes have been dragging on for far too long now, and I am hopeful that by working together with all affected domestic parties, solutions can and should be found. Mr. Speaker, I wish to reaffirm my personal conviction that through the collective celebration of social events, participants in Gibraltarian contribute towards reinforcing our identity, culture, and history as a people and a community. Both the performing and fine arts fraternity have always proved themselves to be very collective within their own specialized areas, and I take this opportunity to congratulate all the groups and individuals who have done Gibraltar extremely proud through their international participation and, in very many cases, even gaining top awards. It is always a personal and collective pleasure to be able to say how proud we are of international achievements of our fellow Gibraltarians. Speaker, during the last term in office, government purchased both the Queen's Cinema and Queen's Hotel sites for the development of the theatre and related activities. There are somewhat mixed feelings among the local community as to how the sites will be developed and to what cost. Government announced through its 2015 election manifesto that a lot of progress on the design of the new Queen's National Theatre had been made in order to make the old Queen's Cinema a venue for touring production. It went on to say that now that preliminary land use design has been finalized, they will continue to work with the Committee of Local Drama Experts to finalize the internal design and facilities required, alongside exploring the possibility of commercial use in a theatre complex facility. This year's estimates show a provision of £1,000 and an improvement of development by expenditure, set aside on the head of one or two projects that had both entitled the theatre. Could it be that the theatre is yet another matter which will remain to be addressed shortly whenever that shortly may be? In respect to the Queen's Cinema site, I sincerely hope that the development will be real value for money and that our local culture in the wider sense of the word, or the word, is enhanced. Local performers may often be heard to say, say that if we can afford £3.5 million for a Tuesday mega concert, then surely a local performer, entertainer, and audience are entitled to ask for a theatre which is fit for purpose and available for 365 days a year. Mr. Speaker, moving on to educational matters, I wish to start by citing once again from a topic that has been before in this chamber. It says, children must be able to play, study, and grow in a peaceful environment. Woe to anyone who stifles their joyful insights to hope. Within the name of the speaker, I can express enough the need to ensure we get it absolutely right when planning and building facilities which will serve our children's educational purposes in preparation for adult life. Not only serving special guidance projects for the revision and expansion of our schools. For our people's benefit, I hope the decisions taken have been based, above all, upon feedback received from the professionals in the field, namely from school teachers themselves. Unfortunately, during this past year, the Volta Peace Administration highlighted that they had at times felt ignored and not consulted on a number of educational reforms that the Department of Education had embarked upon. We have been reassured that September 2019 will see the introduction of a final phase of co-education across all schools in Volta. There is no question that that co-education has been long overdue, and I hope for our children's sake that the new buildings will be completed in time and to the highest of standards. However, Mr. Speaker, many parents, teachers, and even ordinary citizens have expressed serious concerns about the expected inevitable high levels of congestion which seems to be coming around the Waterford area in September. I sincerely hope there will be a sensible and workable traffic plan in place before the schools open this coming September. Given that teachers have reinforced the need for and importance of vertical communication on the current and future reforms in education, I hope that their voices have been heard in the vision being acted upon by government, if it is effective. Again, I fully empathize with the teaching profession who, on the issue of collocation, see a golden opportunity as it left to explore different models within the constraints of the land available to achieve an optimum educational solution. Teachers feel that the issue is not just about what has been provided, but what could have been provided had there been more meaningful consultation with classroom teachers themselves. As both a teacher and a past president of the Volta Teachers Association, and someone who still has educational matters extremely close to his heart, I extend the recommendation to the Minister for Education to listen and continue to work as closely as possible with classroom teachers, albeit alongside the senior management team. Classroom teachers want to be part of any process that changes our educational system and want to be involved in meaningful consultation before final decisions are taken. Surely, the way forward proposed by these professionals can only have contributed to the well-being and best possible future of our children. This is something which I hope we can all agree is paramount. I am pleased to speak to have heard from the Minister that each alignment will now coincide with the year in which pupils are scheduled to move from lower to upper primary and likewise from upper primary to secondary school. This realignment makes logical and educational sense in respect of providing teaching and learning resources within the schools which the schools necessarily require. I would like to take this opportunity to also recommend to the Minister that in their plans for building and enforcing a new school, special consideration be given to current trends in respect of development in school curriculums. An example of this, Mr. Speaker, is the initiative already taken by one of our locally based private schools, which now offers computer science at both GCSE and A level. It is courses like these which will serve to prepare those people to become the good workforce with the goals that we need for tomorrow, and the future will be dominated, as the future will be dominated by digital technology.
Likewise, Mr. Speaker, the CSC has raised the concept of modern apprenticeships in the past, and we still believe we need to offer more in this field than what we currently provide. Those people who do not wish to pursue an academic future need to be provided with the opportunity of a modern apprenticeship program which is properly structured by the same standing as higher education. We need to create a gold standard for an apprenticeship program so that employers have confidence in the system. The time for investment is now, Mr. Speaker, not just in formal academic education heading towards entry into higher education, but also in the coordination of training and skills through vocational courses that carry international accreditation. The Minister for Education has made reference to the introduction of three levels at secondary schools. I welcome this introduction and see it as a step towards a possible introduction of future colleges in favor of people who wish to pursue further or higher education in respect of what are commonly referred to as traditional grades rather than academic, rather than theory or academic qualification. Mr. Speaker, we must not forget the ultimate aim of providing education for our future generations. It is our duty to ensure all people always achieve their maximum potential. While desiring only all the very best in respect of the forthcoming education reform, I cannot abide by reinforcing that the views of the professionals in this field must be heard and acted upon. There is no better formula for success than to cultivate a sense of ownership among all parts within the education of our children. Furthermore, we deeply believe that school teachers are a community that is both needed and from which society will receive new benefits. The fact that they do benefit everyone. Teachers are not a group who are prone to industrial action or making a fuss about nothing. They don't care the language. Mr. Speaker, I concur with the views expressed recently in an opinion piece published last month in the Georgia Chronicle, and I have to quote Mr. Jonathan Adler, who is now lecturing in the United Kingdom. Teachers have, for so long, silently and diligently got on with the underappreciated and deeply challenging job of providing an education, formal or otherwise, to generation after generation of children. The recent exchanges and discrimination with the government over the NASWT program and the way it has been handled has not benefited anyone so far. I hope the government will make a realistic effort to heal this festering wound by making sensible suggestions in order to settle the teachers' blame. No one in the future has been more critical of government spending than the CSC has over the last 7 years. It has advocated prudence and pointed to the dangers of uncontrolled spending. This does not, however, Mr. Speaker, amount to austerity. It is about prioritizing government spending in areas where it is needed, or where, as a society, we are going to get the greatest benefit. The teaching profession is one such area. Mr. Speaker, before I sit down, I must take this opportunity to once again thank you and all the staff of Parliament for the attention and the professional way in which you have dealt with us. I know that you have always led by example in being able to advise members on both sides of the House. And conscious that it is an election year and no one knows what the future will be, I will end up by perhaps quoting the recent meeting
I think it would be appropriate for us to wait now until
briefly this afternoon to hear the two remaining speakers closer with us, so I know that you're important. And we can let that. The House will recess for 3:15 this afternoon.